Come gather round, my friends. I've got a tale to tell about a podcast host that's known so well. Walt Bismarck's the name, a friend of the Jews, with perspective so right, who can refuse? Oy vey, oy vey, you won't want to miss the wisdom and knowledge he won't dismiss. He'll spin you tales, make you laugh and debate with Walt Wright perspectives. It's never too late. Donate your shekels, support the cause. Join the conversation, no need to pause. Subscribe to the podcast, you'll be in the mix with Michigan Air Walls, bringing truth that stinks. Support the cause, join the conversation, no need to pause. Subscribe to the podcast, you'll be in the mix with Michigan Air Walt, bringing truth that sticks.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Walt Wright Perspectives. Today I have, as a guest, Robert Stark. Robert's been around, I guess, kind of adjacent to the same circles that I run in for a long time. I remember him back in, 2015, 2016. He interviewed a couple friends of mine. So, Robert, why don't you describe what your project has been, what you're interested in, like what your own ideological trajectory has been over the past decade, since I think we crossed paths a few times back in the day. What have you been up to since then, and what sort of topics do you write about on Substack?
Yeah, so I've had my Star Truth Radio brand, and right now I've been really active on Substack, but I've had Star Truth Radio for about a decade. And I never really considered I've always been kind of politically homeless and hesitant to adopt labels. But I think if you want to call me alt-right adjacent, I interviewed a lot of those big figures. I have interviewed people like Richard Spencer back in the 2010s, and a number of figures, but I was always kind of politically homeless. I was always careful. I didn't really want to not to adopt labels. And I like the label radical centrist, but I think I had a fairly similar trajectory to you, because I initially became political through the Ron Paul movement. Mm-hmm. And then I saw that as sort of almost like a proto alt-right. And I definitely remember, I'm not sure if we've ever interacted. I've never interviewed you, but I remember your Uncuck the Right Disney parody channel.
I think we spoke on Twitter a few times. I think that's
right. I remember that. But that's So
I remember you. I remember you interviewed a friend of mine. Truth Will Live. It was like the cute Jewish girl, the blonde. Yeah, right. I remember because she was about to appear on one of my songs, but she ended up chickening out. She was supposed to sing one of them. But I remember she talked to you. I think it was you who she talked to about that. But yeah, because she was sort of driven off from the alt-right. I mean, she was always adjacent to it too, but because she was Jewish, there was a big move to sort of purge kind of base Jews or pro-white Jews, I think, towards the end of 2015. And it never really was a totalistic thing. I think a lot of people still stuck around, but it was a thing where they were sort of kept at arm's length. Now you yourself are part Jewish, right?
Yeah, I troll about it, but it's actually a pretty small amount, from a great great grandmother. But some of my articles I'll troll, the really obsessive anti-Semites about it, but it's a pretty far back.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, I think there are a lot of people in America who have
have a similar trajectory to you. I intellectually reject most of the anti-Semitic arguments, but I had a fairly similar trajectory as you, because I was involved with the Ron Paul movement, and then mm-hmm. I kind of saw a lot of the background of a lot of the neocons who were going out of their way to attack Ron Paul, who wasn't at all anything close to anti-Semitic, and I had a sort of knee-jerk reaction, and I went in that direction for maybe a couple years, from about 2009 to maybe 2013, and mm-hmm. I kind of grew out of that phase, and I'm not going to be like apologetic about it in like a moralistic sense, but I just saw like later on became more mature and saw like intellectual flaws with those arguments. But that seems to be a pretty similar trajectory as you went through.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it probably, you know, it took me a few years to reach the same conclusions, but yeah, I fully agree. And I guess I've always been like, there's always been part of me, even when I wasn't anti-Semite, that I was sort of philo-Semitic in the sense of like, you know, like I think obviously if you're someone who's kind of like intellectually, you're going to respect Jews for their, you know, scholastic nature, for having a very high verbal IQ, for being, I don't know, just good at debate and rhetoric and sort of shaping the parameters of the discussion. I mean, that's something, even if it's very annoying when it comes to something like Ron Paul in Israel, you know, game has to recognize game, right? And as somebody who was doing propaganda at the time, I mean, I did just recognize that it was something they were objectively quite talented at and, you know, should be lauded for. And I mean, even now, like, it is something that I want to do a lot of outreach to Jews in a sort of like moderately pro-white capacity, because I think that like, the Gaza war has sort of like changed the metapolitical situation in America, has kind of changed like where everyone's coalitions are most naturally drawn. And I think that for a lot of Jews, it sort of makes sense for them to be much more pro-white now. But you know, you've written about this, right? Like you wrote about like the four, like two different axes of like pro-white versus anti-white, and then like Zionist versus anti-Zionist. Maybe you could talk a bit about that piece, because I think that was really interesting.
I'm trying to think which one in particular is, but I've noticed, well, right now, the big issue is we're undergoing this massive realignment on issues of like white identity and Zionism, where a lot of people, we're seeing sides switch. So we're seeing woke people become basically sound like anti-Semites, and you're seeing a lot of more conservative Jews who in the past would have been totally antagonistic towards anything like remotely pro-white, maybe reconsider like a soft pro-white position. But I think, besides that realignment, I feel things are much more openly now. Like during the era of the alt-right, you were in these tribes and you had like you had the conservatives versus the hardcore racists. And I'm actually optimistic about where things are going. I actually really appreciate the more open environment now where people of different backgrounds can speak with each other like more openly. I think you've had the same observation.
Yeah, I think there were a few things that happened. I mean, like as you you know discussed, like the Israel Gaza war, I think that did just kind of like stir the pot a little bit. But I think also the Biden years have just been kind of, I don't know, like if it feels like sort of like a nothing burger, it feels like nothing interesting has been happening. And I think there's this almost a climate of boredom. Whereas I feel like during the Trump years, it, like everything was so chaotic that people really hardened into their coalitions, and they were less exploratory. And then I think also, so, you know, hopefully if we do, you know, get Trump back in office, it's not going to just like harden things up again. I mean, I think also like another impact has just been like Richard Hanania coming to Substack and sort of like showing how it's done, showing how you can sort of.
I've actually met him.
Really? Oh, okay. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I saw him speak at this event in LA, sort of a Dime Square adjacent crowd. I just met him really briefly.
Oh, was that the debate he had with Yarvin?
Not the Yarvin debate. He gave a speech that was run by this guy named Filthy Armenian.
Okay, gotcha. Okay.
One other interesting observation that I have is the whole issue with – so basically what Trump did, Trump really radicalized the left, but he caused this political alliance between leftists and the more establishmentarian neoliberal types. And under Biden, in some ways, like for this reason, part of me is kind of happy that – Biden won, because things are more chill and there's a more so kind of socially or culturally libertarian environment. Things are less tense than they were under Trump, or even more or less tense than they were right after January 6th. But the other trend I've noticed is the whole Israel issue. And I think income inequality to a lesser degree is causing this major schism between the hard left and the more establishmentarian neoliberal types.
Right. I mean, also just, I mean, they're embracing a lot of really crazy social politics that like, you know, like a lot of the sort of establishmentarian liberal, or not even so much establishmentarian, it's just like, I don't know, like liberal, but like interested in like having like a free and open debate, like almost like libertarian adjacent, or people just like Matt Iglesias, who are just, you know, intelligent technocrats. They're really contemptuous of how a lot of these extreme leftists will just reject the idea of free speech and open inquiry, how they are just like, they want to clamp down on anyone who disagrees with them. You know, they're taking over a lot of these sort of government, like a lot of like staffers, entry-level staffers in DC, a lot of these think tanks, you know, any sort of like left-wing advocacy group, a lot of the rank and file are now these hardcore leftists who, you know, are very anti-Zionist, who are very like radically left-wing on social policy. And, you know, first, if you're just like some Gen X or like geriatric millennial liberal, like, I mean, a lot of this stuff is crazy to you. And it's
really shocking. And I don't mean that in a moralistic way, just in a kind of neutral observation. Cause I remember being like an older millennial growing up in a heavily Jewish part of LA. Like I remember the hypersensitivity to anti-Semitism and things like Holocaust awareness, yeah, remembrance, and just how much of a, and also because I had a lot of like Jewish friends who had grandparents who fled Nazi Germany. So like they remember the sensitivity, and I find it just like so bizarre how actually anti-whiteness led to anti-Semitism being sort of normalized on the left.
Yeah. Well, I mean, do you think it's really anti-Semitism or do you think it is?
Well,
it's
twofold. So I think from their perspective, they don't see themselves as anti-Semites. I think they just see themselves opposing settler colonialism and white supremacy. But the rhetoric is so potent that to someone who's from a Jewish background, it's going to come across as extremely anti-Semitic, even though that's not how the left, like the leftists who are anti-Israel, it's not necessarily how they see things, but that's right, just sort of how it comes across. Because I think the distinctions between white Gentiles and white Jews, they're not as distinct as they were in the past. I think Jews are seen by young people, especially people of color, as just a subset of whites.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like, because it seems like that was something that only happened over the past decade. Because it seems like, I mean, culturally speaking, it did feel like Jews were a subset of white 10 years ago to some extent. But anything adjacent to Israel, or when it came to like the political, when anything adjacent to white nationalism came up, it definitely felt like there was like a strong impulse from Jews to resist that. Whereas among Zoomer Jews, you don't really see that same
I've also noticed there's been a big, I don't know what the term is, it the dissident right or the post-right, but the current scene, and I don't like a lot of there's anti-Semites saying that it's part of controlled opposition. I obviously don't buy into that, but I've noticed like a big increase in Zoomer Jews and anti-establishment politics. Well, I kind of remember like when I was in the Ron Paul movement, like it seemed that there was this older generation of Jews who were mostly either liberals or neocons. There is a political shift going on with younger Jews too.
I think it really is like just not having grandparents who fled the Holocaust or whatever. I think that like, you know, if it just isn't something that's personally salient to you, like to them, like the Jewish kid I interviewed on my podcast, he said that to him, the discrimination he's experienced over his life has mostly been him as a white guy. Right. So, I mean, I think that that's how they're thinking of things. And I think, you know, I think that if you are pro-white, you need to be nimble and flexible, and you need to acknowledge that, hey, look, the coalitional forces are shifting and these people are our allies, right? You know, like you can't just chase them away just because of what was going on 10 years ago. The world is always changing. And but see, like the hardcore anti-Semites are into like the whole, you know, like they view everything as like a conspiracy. I mean, I think there's like some of that insofar as, you know, people will just emergently be sort of ethnically nepotist. But I mean, I don't think it's as big of a deal as they thought it was, but it's like a tricky thing to talk about because like there is a sense where in the past you would be repressed for even just saying what I just did. Whereas nowadays, I think saying what I just did, as long as you're respectful about it and you position it in the right way, it's not cancelable. And I think I've demonstrated that. So I think it's sort of
this. My assessment of you is you disavowed the alt-right and white nationalism, but you didn't seem to really go in the Richard Hanania direction either. Like you found a more balanced, nuanced approach.
Well, you notice I disavowed white nationalism. I never disavowed the alt-right. And I said that the alt-right was justified in everything it did. And I said that the anti-Semitism that existed back then, it was responding to, I mean, what we just talked about, right? It was a specific cultural ecology where, you know, there was the Ron Paul thing going on where there was this sort of alliance between left-wing and right-wing Jews over Israel. You know, all these boomer Jews whose grandparents were, you know, in the Holocaust or whatever. But, like, I think the world is different now. And I think that, number one, I don't want to be focused on pro-white stuff over everything else. So I don't really consider myself a white nationalist. I consider myself somewhat identitarian and somewhat adjacent to that world still, but I don't really consider myself like either a hard white nationalist or a soft white nationalist. Like Jared Taylor is somebody who I would call a soft white nationalist because he's someone who that's his like main thing, right? But it's not like clearly, like everything he says is basically within the Overton window. Maybe, like, the only extent to which he'd be outside the Overton window is the extent to which he only, like, really focuses on that, you know, at the expense of everything else. But I mean, everything he says on an object level is you could say it a CPAC easily, right? So, you know, it's a weird situation we're in. And I think it's a lot less to do with what you believe specifically, as opposed to, like, how you say it. And if you have, like, a high enough verbal IQ to, like, reach people where they are, you know what I mean?
What do you think about something like a right-wing multiculturalism or ethno-pluralism as an alternative to nationalism?
That's basically what I support, yeah. I mean, I would say, though, that it has to be groups that are fairly high IQ and groups that can assimilate into the white majority. So it's sort of castizo-futurism. Do you remember that back in the day?
Yeah, that's more kind of – like, it's sort of a hybrid because you have all these different paradigms. You have civic nationalism, you have, like, hardline ethno-nationalism, you have the sort of hybrid paleoconservatism where it's sort of a hybrid of white nationalism and civic nationalism, and then you have, like, ethno-pluralism or right-wing multiculturalism, which I'm more sympathetic to, but there's all these different nuanced variances, so...
Right.
It's sort of like, castizo futurism, that meme, it's sort of a melting pot idea, but it's like a melting pot that's conditional, that includes some people and excludes others. So that's kind of based on what we had in this country where, like, the Irish and Italians were at some point accepted, but there were still groups that were excluded.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think the general idea is, you know, some groups can melt in more easily than others. And I think, you know, if you have, like, Jews, Armenians, Cubans, I mean, they're basically white, number one. And number two, to the extent that they're not, like, their kids and certainly their grandkids will basically just be white. Now, I do think you need a sort of social environment that encourages assimilation. And I think you do need, I'm in favor of interracial marriage, you know, to the extent that it sort of, like, bleaches other populations. Now, I would ideally like the country to, like, phenotypically, I don't want, like, paleness to disappear. Right. But it's less important to me, I think, than just the sort of temperament and the sort of spirit, the sort of Faustian spirit of, you know, European civilization, which I think that you see in, like, Cubans and you see in to a certain extent among Jews. It's a little different, but it definitely have that Faustian drive. Right. Like, they'll definitely push themselves to a level, you know, that you don't really see in the Occident. I think, you know, similarly, I guess, like, when it comes to East Asian immigration, like, I think it's okay and, like, to a certain extent, and same with Indian immigration, but, like, you know, like, taking over, like, Brahmins or, like, very high IQ Chinese, like, you know, I think it's good to fill some specialized tech roles, but I think that it needs to be, you know, you can't let it be so high that you start to get resentment from, like, native white elites, which is what you're starting to see towards Brahmins in Silicon Valley, which I'm very much opposed to. Like, I'm friends with a lot of Brahmin Indians, so I sort of want to, like, get my arms around that, and that's why I've sort of made a very active effort to have conversations, you know, with people from that background. You know, two of my closest friends on Substack right now, Rajiv and Sai, like, both of them are, Sai's actually an immigrant from India, and she hasn't decided whether she's going to go back yet or not. And then Rajiv is a second generation immigrant. He was born actually in the same state as me, Arizona. So he and I are, like, almost exactly the same age. We have a pretty similar background, except he is, has a Brahmin ethnic heritage. And so, you know, like, it's interesting. He and I can discuss a lot of these things and discuss the sort of resentment that's brewing towards Indians in Silicon Valley, which, you know, he worked at Google for a little while. And I guess, like, because I think that the Brahmin question is going to be treated very similarly to the Jewish question in a few years. And I think that the resentment's already bubbling. And I want to sort of, like, I want to play a part in preventing that from turning into something, like, bad or hateful. You know what I mean? Because I do think that, like, we have things to learn from them. I think that white elites, like, can benefit from the wisdom of Brahmin elites that, you know, that they can bring from their own heritage, and we can sort of cross-pollinate and sort of grow intellectually together. So I do think that there is room for multiculturalism. Also, I think that competition with Brahmins and with Jews and with other, you know, Armenians, groups like that, I think it helps white people be more agentic, be more Faustian, like be more, you know, like, 'cause I think when I look back at European civilization and history, like, it was always that sort of like outward facing impulse that, like, spoke most to me, like, right, like colonialism or, you know, like just the age of exploration in general, right, or the Roman Empire, like Rome was always expanding, was always looking outward, or like Alexander the Great wanting to go, you know, conquer Persia, and then, like, he was trying to conquer all the way through India, and it's like the idea that being multicultural or outward looking or expansive is somehow at odds with being pro-white. Like, Alexander the Great would look at you like you're retarded if you said something like that, right?
I mean, there's, like, with multiculturalism, there is like the idea that you have a bunch of people who are constantly competing and it gets very cutthroat, and that can produce innovation, but it also can lead to a lot of resentment. And then there's like more kind of like ethno-pluralism, where people form like their own separate institutions where they're offered, they have a sense of security through their own institutions or their own like ethnic enclave. So you could have like a European American enclave next to a Hindu or a Mexican enclave, and they're separate, but they coexist. And it's probably going to be probably going to end up being like some hybrid of both those models, because one model, like a pure enclavism, could be, that might be too rigid, but if you just have a sort of like free for all, like Richard Hernania is more like neoliberal and open immigration, but he's also like a hardcore social Darwinist, and that kind of society leads to a lot of cutthroat competition and people being dislocated and more deracinated, and that breeds to resentment. So I guess the question is finding like the right balance, because people do need things like community and patronage networks that offer security.
I agree. And I think that that's one historical source of tension, I think, between the sort of white majority and I guess high-performing ethnic groups, whether they're, I mean, Jews are the most prominent example, but you also have Armenians, you have Brahmins now. I think, you know, a lot of those other ethnic groups have their patronage networks, and they have like their own internal networking things. And I think that like that can sometimes be, I mean, it is ethnic nepotism to some extent, right? But I don't think that like those groups think of it as like a conspiracy. It's more just like, why wouldn't you do that? It's obvious, right? And I think that like white people need to start doing the same thing, right? And that's what I've kind of been working on with Noah Ravoy, who's a collaborator of mine. He's a life coach on Twitter. You know, he's big into like sort of forming organizations, kind of like behind the scenes.
So basically like ethnic patronage networks.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But for white people internally that we can have in parallel to Jews and Brahmins and everybody else. And, you know, like
then there's going to be less resentment, because if one side has it and one side is expected to reject nepotism and be totally atomized, it's either going to lead to the individualistic side being totally crushed, or that side building up this really extreme resentment and really turning on those other groups. So I think that that's absolutely what's needed.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's funny, I was talking to a Jewish guy on my show a few episodes ago, and he was mentioning how, like, Jews and Italians used to, like, closely collaborate. And there are still, like, sort of Italian, I mean, a lot of the younger people, it's more of a boomer thing. Like, younger Italians don't really like to participate in this as much because they're more assimilated. But there absolutely are sort of, like, Italian ethnic organizations where they give out scholarships, they give out, you know, there's, like, business networking. So, you know, like, it's not like white people have no history of this. It's more just, like, we did it as ethnics, right? Right? But, like, Italians used to do it the exact same way that Jews did. So I'm just proposing that we sort of leverage that history and go back to, you know, utilizing, we can have these like sort of voluntaristic social orders where we can help each other out and where it doesn't feel like, you know, like there's such a low floor, I suppose.
You had this post that went viral where you said that you lived in this homogenous all middle class place in the Midwest, which like the dissident right types would view as utopia, but you ended up really finding it extremely boring. And this went viral on Twitter. But it's interesting because I found a lot of the guys who were in the alt-right were not from those places. Many of them were, so I grew up in LA, so many of them were from more multicultural urban or cosmopolitan environments, but you actually found that kind of homogenous, high trust, middle class environment in the Midwest to be extremely boring.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because a lot of people were saying to me on Twitter, like, you know, what do you expect? What does this guy expect? Right. Like, obviously that this is going to be the case. But I guess like for me, I was thinking that it would basically be people with my temperament on some level, like people who would still like enjoy discussing big ideas, but they just would be, you know, there wouldn't be crime. Right. Right. But, or like, you know, there wouldn't be like, I wasn't expecting that, like, everyone would be very gossipy. You know, they'd be obsessed with college sports. They'd be just not very welcome towards outsiders. And then, you know, I should say I was in Omaha, Nebraska, which was, yeah, a lot of people in the Midwest are saying that's actually like for them, like a large town, like to them, like those people are too much like city people for them. Whereas for me, they felt very provincial. Now again, like it's not like I was raised in New York City or something. I was raised in Phoenix, Arizona. And then I ended up moving to Florida a little bit for like a year after.
I might go to Phoenix for the first time. I think later this summer, I might go there and then take a short trip to Sedona.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool place. I mean, I guess like the weird thing is it's sort of like LA's little brother, right? It's always like LA 20 years ago. So, you know, they say that whatever social changes are happening in LA, they go to Phoenix like 20 years after that. So it's sort of a similar mindset, but then, you know, they also hate Californians in Arizona because there's the mindset that like all the Californians are coming over to get lower taxes or whatever, and then they're turning Arizona blue.
Right.
But that's what, I mean, every state out west says that about California though, right? So, I mean, same thing in Colorado, but, yeah, no, I don't know. I guess like I then moved to Florida, and I like Florida is more my vibe than Arizona these days because it's more like it's very similar, right? Because both Florida and Arizona, like almost no one lived there until air conditioning was invented. Because I mean, both of them, it's like just way too fucking hot. Like it's like hell without air conditioning, right? But then you know, after you get air conditioning, both states, you start getting a lot of snowbirds, which are like old people from up north who are moving down for retirement. So both Arizona and Florida have a ton of retirees. You also have you know, Californians going to Arizona for lower taxes, New Yorkers going to Florida for the same reason, you know, a lot of sort of economic migrants. And then in both states, you have the mixture of a sort of like redneck, you know, like sort of
rednecks, Jews, Cubans,
right.
Blacks.
Phoenix, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's a sort of, I would say both Arizona and Florida, like Florida has more black people than Arizona, but it's, they're still not really culturally, I guess, as influential. Like, I mean, it's not like there aren't a ton of them here, but like it doesn't really feel like they're, I don't know, in control of the culture. It definitely feels like the culture in Florida is like there's three parts. There's the redneck, there's the Hispanic, and then there's the sort of Midwesterner who moves, or the New Yorker who moves, you know, to get lower taxes, and then old people. So, I mean, I guess that like it does produce a certain vitality, especially like the redneck versus the Cuban combination. Like, I think it and what it does is it produces a kind of right-wing multiculturalism where everybody is sort of used to getting along with people from different types, but like we do still kind of like stick to ourselves. But like,
I think California sort of has that. But the thing is, like, white Californians, excluding the more ethnic communities like Jews and Armenians, are just hyper individualistic and deracinated. Like, I'd say, like, this, because of the history of being a colony of a colony, like, white mm-hmm. Californians are probably some of the most individualistic people on earth. But once, if they, for some reason, like if they evolve or there is some kind of ethnogenesis in the future, then it has the potential to be that. But I think California, yeah, California is sort of, I mean, California does have aspects of ethnopluralism, but the thing is the like white Californians are just hyper-individualistic, but they still fundamentally, I used to be a supporter of Calexit, and I quit the movement because they went in too much of a left-wing direction. I don't support it anymore, but I think it'll be interesting to see if Calexit were to happen, if like white Californians would evolve an identity, because they're very caught up in America's whole thing where anything to do with nationalism or tribalism is linked to Trump and America's red versus blue. So I don't know if I quite see that happening
weird.
In California. It's weird.
It's weird because like the West Coast is just generally more individualistic than the East Coast, obviously. And then there's a certain extent to which like people associate the sort of like San Francisco mindset with like libertarianism in terms of like the Bitcoin bros and the sort of, but then there was a big influx of those guys into Miami a little while ago, where like a lot of people were relocating from California to Miami because they were sort of saying that California had just grown too left wing, especially because of COVID, right? Because Newsom, like how long did Newsom have the lockdown? Wasn't it like 2 years?
Yeah, about 2 years.
Like, Jesus Christ, like, what was that like? Because, like, for me, I just, like, stopped thinking about COVID because DeSantis, like, ended it, like, right away, you know? So that must have been hell.
It was insane, but, I mean, luckily for me, I live somewhere where I hike a lot and there's a lot of outdoor activities, which is good. But I think it would have been hell if you lived in a more, like, urban part of L.A.
Yeah, you know, like, the great thing about California, it's literally, like, the best climate of anywhere on Earth. Like, there's, like, nowhere, you know, like, if you really love nature, there's nowhere else that's better. But it's almost like there's so many people now. It's like, can you even enjoy it as much anymore? Because I remember, like, my family, even in the 90s, California was beautiful. Like, as a little kid, we'd go to San Diego or go to, you know that place in San Diego where there's, like, Mission Beach? It has, like, the roller coaster?
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. That place was, oh, my God. I just have so many good memories. And, like, going to Disneyland every year, you know, we'd pack up on a road trip from Phoenix to L.A. And, I remember there's you know, there's those are like hills in the south of California. They have like the windmills everywhere. And then there's that like dinosaur. You know the dinosaur you can climb inside? Do you know what I'm talking about? It's like a tourist trap.
Is it the desert?
Yeah, yeah.
There's windmills. There's the windmills near Palm Springs. And then there's the windmills east of the Bay Area.
Yeah, I just like all that is like so engraved in my childhood mythology. You know what I mean? So I do. I still kind of think of California as like the promised land, and it still has that sort of like mythology in American folklore or whatever, right? Because like for so long, California got settled like way before other Western states, right? But then like I guess I don't know. Like I feel like for a lot of and it's like annoying when conservatives countersignal California because it is like
I'm really sick. I like to kind of countersignal conservatives because I'm. There's many things about it that it's one of the, it's still one of the most beautiful places on earth. Mm-hmm. Like even a lot of the decay, like there is, it's more of a gradual decay, but I'm really sick of like all these right wingers. They just like to shit on California. Like I like to offer kind of like a counterbalance to that.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely worthwhile. I mean, especially like there's a reason, like people talk about how like in San Francisco, there's shit everywhere, but it's like, I mean, there's a reason people still live there despite there being shit everywhere. Right? I mean, it's like probably the biggest concentration of like genius on the planet. Right. I mean, there's
it's
a reason.
It's one of the few places they have the natural beauty. I'm taking a road trip to Northern California in a few days, but like the Bay Area that has like the natural beauty, but it's also, despite the problems, it's one of the few places in the Western United States where you feel that feels quasi-European. And you have like dense walkable cities.
Yeah, no, that's true. And I think there is I've always sort of valued California for being sort of a counterweight to the East Coast in terms of like, you know, like cultural power. Like the idea that like everything is concentrated east of the Mississippi, like as someone who grew up in Arizona, that was always really annoying to me. Right. And because there is just a huge part of the country that feels totally alienated from that. And like it is sort of important that because California punches so far above its weight, I mean, and its weight is already so huge in terms of just demographically, like that is sort of important to giving people on the West Coast kind of like cultural representation. But I think it's annoying to people that it is so just like avowedly left wing, you know, like they wish there were some, because there is like a very right wing Western. I mean, even like the fact that Nixon and Reagan were both governors of California, right, at one point. I think Nixon wasn't. He was a congressman, and then he ran for governor, and he lost, right?
Right.
Yeah, but Reagan was a governor, and Nixon was a congressman, right? I mean, like you know, a lot of the right came. I mean, and then Barry Goldwater came from Arizona.
Even
I mean,
like, today, like the electorally, it's solidly Democrat, but a lot of the interesting intellectual stuff online is coming from Californians, like mm-hmm. someone like a Steve Saylor, and a lot mm-hmm. of interesting intellectuals are coming out of California.
Yeah, and I remember back in the day when I was a libertarian, I got involved in like the paleo diet and all that. And I remember there was like Mark Sisson. I don't know if you ever read him, but
I've heard of him, but I've never read him.
Yeah, I think he was in California, but I think he might have moved to Florida. I forget, but like I do remember that a lot of those guys, you know,
Rexstein too. That's Bay Area centric.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny though. I do feel like there has been a sort of, and tell me if you agree with this. I feel like there's been a sort of rivalry between California and Florida, and there, like a lot of those guys have been moving to Florida. And like, I think there's been like that general trend, right? And like even like the Newsom versus DeSantis debate. Like I think there's a sense in which like the new sort of like quasi tropical or quasi like you know like the vacation spot that people move to, right? Like the sort of, and I think especially on the right, like DeSantis was in a good position to sort of like position Florida as the new California, and like I think he was very much trying to do that, but then he fucked up so bad in his.
Yeah, he's gone too much. I think DeSantis's problem was picking a fight with Trump, but he's gone too much in a more kind of conservative, like Bush era evangelical direction.
I agree. I fully agree. I mean, the 6-week abortion ban was so stupid. Like, why? Like, obviously, you're not going to get any like national support after you do something like that. I've been telling this to people. I think what he should have done is he should have gotten to Trump's right rhetorically while sort of being quasi centrist or like even just kind of like center right, I guess, like in terms of politics. I think that he could have won the nomination then, but I think he was just too weak. He just didn't have the balls. And or he was just being advised by like really stupid people, because his campaign was horribly managed from the very start.
Oh yeah, definitely.
But no, it's interesting. But so I guess like let me ask you about that though. Like, do you feel like there is any sort of like tacit national rivalry at this point between California and Florida?
I do, but I see it more as a broader like red versus blue divide. I guess it's a broader red versus blue divide, but because there is a bit of a brain drain out of California, that's another angle to it. A lot of like tech bros moving to Florida, so it's red versus blue. Then there's the other angle with the brain drain.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know what's interesting is that Texas seems to be sort of sleeping. Like it seems, even though Texas is still much bigger than Florida, and I mean economically, it's certainly vibrant in a lot of different sectors. But it seems like Florida has sort of supplanted Texas as the sort of like conservative like hub in a lot of ways. And Abbott's, it's not like Abbott doesn't do, like Abbott does the same stuff that DeSantis does. If anything, he's like a bit more aggressive, but I don't know. For some reason, it seems like Texas just hasn't been as influential or something. Why do you think that
maybe is? Maybe because its urban areas are very blue.
Oh, you know what? I think you're probably right. Yeah.
That because are their elite is more, because electorally they're similar, and Texas might be slightly more red electorally, but I think Florida has a conservative elite, while Texas's elite is drifted fairly blue.
That's a really good theory, yeah. I think that's true. And also, like, the Florida Republican Party is, well, I mean, it's not like the Texas Republican Party is bad, but the Florida Republican Party is so much better than the Florida Democrat Party, just in relative terms. Whereas I think in Texas, like, the Democrats, like, have come fairly close to, like, winning a Senate seat a few times. You know, they always fall a little bit short, but, you know, like, there's definitely that impulse to turn Texas blue that I think, like, it's weird. Like, I think Democrats still want to turn Texas blue, but they've almost given up on Florida at this point. Maybe it's because of just the trend lines. But, yeah.
Do you have thoughts on the broader scene that replaced the alt-right? I don't. You said you don't like the term dissident right. I also hear the term post-right, but it's more decentralized, but there's all these different splinter factions, like ranging from NRX Times Square adjacent types to the Groypers, but you don't really, you're sort of similar to me in the sense you seem kind of politically homeless and unaffiliated, which is a good thing. But do you have thoughts on a direction of where things are now?
I fully agree with you. I think after Charlottesville, there's been this sort of splintering effect where everybody's kind of going in their own direction and everybody is, you know, like wanting to sort of build their own little bubble, their own little status hierarchy that's like separate from everybody else. And I think it makes sense. Like, you know, you sort of want to like, you want to have loose ranks after something like Charlottesville, and it's you know, it's kind of good that we've been decentralized. But I think that there were a lot of young guys who were eager for leadership who you know, they felt there was a vacuum. And I think the problem was a lot of guys of my generation and probably your generation too, we sort of like retreated into the shadows or retreated into doing our own thing after Charlottesville. And the most prominent person was Nick Fuentes. And I think he sort of was that only figure who could provide that kind of leadership to all these young guys. And, you know, I think that there's a lot I like about Fuentes, but there's, you know, he was 19 when it happened, right? I think maybe 20. So, I mean, I think he was just sort of too young to really serve as an effective leader. And I think that, I think he's certainly much more mature these days, but, I don't know if he necessarily led everybody in the best direction. And I guess there's part of me that sort of wants to provide more guidance to like the Zoomer guys who weren't necessarily led in the most productive direction during those years, right? Because I think that the thing is, I feel like until Trump is out of the national political scene, there's not a lot of like sort of concrete object level political goals that are super high priority. Because I just feel like you can't count on Trump for much. And, you know, the whole Project 2025 thing, it's sort of interesting. I hope it goes well. And, you know, but I'm not really holding my breath. And I'm more sort of interested in creating behind the scenes on Substack and on other platforms, sort of.
And you said like things like patronage networks or like a coffee salon for intellectuals. Yes. To gather, like to get anti-establishment elite human capital. But I agree, I'm totally pessimistic about politics. Is another interesting, so you have a one extreme, you have like Nick Fuentes, the Groypers, the Christian nationalists. And then I was listening to your podcast with Rachel Haywire, and she said the post-left kind of gentrified what remained of the dissident right. So it's sort of like you have these like Dime Square adjacent types, and they overlap with NRX. Do you have thoughts on that scene?
I think, you know, I like listening to them, and I think they're cool and everything. But I, you know, I think that they, when you're in New York, there's only so much you can do, right? And, you know, like if you want to be accepted by the New York social elite, you know, there's only so far you can go. And I guess I'm just not interested in the whole Manhattan scene that much because to me it just feels very like controlled by like mean girls. And it is just sort of like culturally left wing, kind of attractively so, you know, just sort of by dint of.
And then it's interesting how that ended up kind of merging. And some people will blame like the Peter Thiel patronage network for this. For some reason, it ended up merging with the neo-reactionary scene, which was actually more Bay Area and Yarvin.
Yeah, to be honest, I'm not that familiar with Yarvin's work. Like, I've never just been interested in that. Like, you know, I think I'm aware of, like, the idea of the cathedral, and I was sort of, like, tangentially aware of his ideas, you know, just by dint of having been in the alt-right. But, like, it never was that interesting to me. And I guess it's almost just an aesthetic thing. Like, I just don't find that vibe to me my vibe. And I sort of want to create something sort of Florida-based, right? That's sort of, you know, that's sort of more culturally adjacent to the old alt-right, that, you know, like maybe like...
And Yarman simply seems to kind of worship power for the sake of power, so he... I totally disagree with him, but he worships power for the sake of power, so he... I wrote a critique of his article where he wants Joe Biden to become a monarch, which I sort of get where he's coming from, but I disagree.
Yeah, I mean, when I hear something like that, I just sort of roll my eyes. And like the whole like Rufo versus Yarvin debate, like I wasn't really paying attention to it, but I look at what Rufo has done and I sort of just instinctively kind of side with him in that, you know, but I never was really that interested in that. I guess there's part of me that's, like, I want to build the elite human capital, but I'm not necessarily interested in, like, purely esoteric intellectualism either. Like, I sort of want to be culturally accessible. I mean, I like that they exist, don't get me wrong. But I want to sort of be, like, semi-exoteric and semi-accessible to the masses. And I guess I'm kind of interested in practical propaganda, like figuring out how to sort of, like, sanitize and mainstream things that you're not allowed to talk about, but things that are just, you know, hugely salient to the, I guess, to the average American's politics. So, like, for instance, like, the issue of... So Hanania wrote that article, like, America has a black nationalism problem, not a balkanization problem, where he was talking about America's racial strife is more along the axis of black people versus everybody else versus, you know, white versus everyone else.
I think he even referenced L.A. specifically in that article.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I mean, because in L.A., like, you know, you have the Armenians.
I'm an L.A. native. Like, there is the problem. There are problems with L.A., the problem – there is petty crime in like the urban cores and urban decay. There's people are fairly atomized. It's hyper competitive and there's a housing crisis. There's a failure of institutions like the Democratic Party and the school system. But despite all those problems, there really isn't any like, you don't really notice any overt like racial tension or animosity.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's weird. Like you wonder, like if it weren't for the black thing, like would there be more animosity? Right. Or does that like sort of just like serve as such a powerful access, like everything else sort of like is filtered through that. And I think it's sort of an open question, but I guess my tendency is to think that America is very good at assimilating most immigrants. Right. And, though I will say that it does just seem to me like Hispanics in Arizona, where I grew up, who are very similar to Hispanics in California. It seems to me that they are just like way more left wing, almost by disposition, you know, because you have like the Cesar Chavez, you have like the whole, you know, like that sort of culture down there.
Closer culturally to California than New Mexico or Texas.
Well, I mean, because if you look at like Florida or Texas, like the Hispanics there are pretty conservative and they, even new ones who come in, they sort of will assimilate into that, into a few generations. I mean, Ron DeSantis literally turned Puerto Ricans like 50-50, like Puerto Ricans voted like Italians in the 2022 election, which I mean, like Cubans have always been kind of conservative, but Puerto Ricans, like they've always been kind of liberal. So the fact that they sort of assimilated into that sort of like Cubano style Florida culture, like is proof to me that that Castizo futurism has legs. Right now, I don't know if that's going to be the case in the Southwest is the thing, because if you just look at the voting pattern,
I'm kind of nuanced about this. So this may seem kind of schizo, but like I support Castizo futurism for Florida. But I think for California, like I think the Anglo minority should sort of assert themselves more, their own identity, and more kind of like Whipple but ethnocentric Anglo or white identity. So I'm schizo in the sense like I do support Castizo futurism for Florida, but maybe less so for California.
It's not schizo at all because I think like having lived
for dualism, like one of my upcoming articles is like dualism as a foundation for a new political movement. I also use the term theosophical tribalism.
Yeah, I mean, because the thing is, people don't
realize. Say intersectional identitarian.
Yeah, I think we're talking about the same thing. But like what people don't realize is that Hispanics in Florida are like middle-class people from like Colombia, Venezuela, or, you know, Cuba, who are fleeing like communists, right? Whereas like a lot of them are mostly white, right? Whereas if you go to even the ones who are darker, they tend to be like tall and like very good looking. I mean, whereas I remember growing up in Arizona, I mean, like I don't mean to sound too crudely racist, but a lot of these people were like 4 foot tall, like communists, like, you know.
Well, there is in California. So California Latinos, they vote majority Democrat, but there are some inroads. It actually, like in the Central Valley, there's been some inroads towards. Well, I think during the recall election, it lost against Newsom, but among Hispanic men, there was a modest tilt rightwards in California, actually. So there's a lot of nuance, and there's even California has a lot of different subgroups. So you have like Central Valley, like farm community, Mexican communities that are more socially conservative. But then like the Bay Area, you have the LA Mexican American culture. But like I've heard in Oakland, like Oakland Latinos are almost like New York Puerto Ricans, like they're really into hip hop. So there's like a lot of diversity even among in California.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I think the problem is, like, I mean, the vast majority of them are Mexican American, right?
Yeah.
So I do think that there's just, I mean, you know, having grown up in Arizona, like the sort of like Mexican, the Chicano culture in America is just so, like, it is more like similar to like Black people in terms of like, they do kind of think of themselves as like an underclass or like a subaltern group that like has sort of been historically oppressed. And they've adopted a lot of the same aesthetics. And see, this is one of the reasons I became a white nationalist, was because I thought of Hispanics in the same way I did Black people. Because in Arizona, like, they kind of are, right? Whereas in Florida, like, they're not at all. They're like Italians. So it's like, it's weird. It's like, if I were still living in Arizona, I might still be more sympathetic towards that view, because it is just such a powerful and like really obnoxious thing. Cause I remember I went to like, in my university, I went to Arizona State. There was a big fucking map on the wall. That was the old like Aztlan map, right? That has like the old borders where like Mexico controlled parts of the
U.S. One trend I've noticed is, so Black identity politics is at an all-time high right now. Asians like have historically were less into identity politics in the past, but they're asserting their identity politics. Indians especially, even more so for the first time. I know my observation is with Chicano identity politics, it actually peaked in the aughts, in the zeros, and then it's moderated slightly in the 2010s. That's been my observation.
Well, okay, that's good, because I think Chicano identity politics that was like the main things that made me a more white nationalist. Cause in Arizona at that time, it was just like so fucking scary.
Yeah, right? When I was living in LA in the zeros, especially when like Antonio Villaraigosa was mayor, like I felt like there was this really aggressive Chicano nationalism in LA. And I had a similar reaction politically as you did, but I think things in California feel much more chill now, actually.
Okay. No, that's interesting. And it's interesting because I remember I was reading, so like when Arizona went blue in 2020, a lot of people were blaming like Mexican immigration, but I remember reading some analysis that it was actually like Californian like suburbanites moving into Arizona who had like caused that. It wasn't even so much like Mexican immigration, because like obviously the illegals can't vote, right? And I don't even know how much Mexican immigration there has been into the Southwest over recent years. So
I think it's declining. The recent migrant surge is all South Americans.
Right, or like Central Americans, right?
Right.
So, yeah, which like that's its own beast, I mean. Because, I mean, a lot of those people are fleeing like gang violence, right?
Yeah.
Or like, you know, like they're sort of like quasi-refugees. Though there's the one country, was it Costa Rica, like or Nicaragua? I forget. Like one country where they just elected that Middle Eastern guy who's like putting everyone in jail.
Yeah, El Salvador.
El Salvador, right, yeah, yeah. Well, hopefully he'll just annex the whole region. He can stop. Just lock everyone. We should just have him be like the global refugee center, right?
This is like off topic, but I wanted to ask you like what your thoughts are on the impacts of personality types on politics, because like the alt-right attracted a totally different personality type is normie conservatives. And in some ways, like more like liberals, because you think of liberals as being like high in the trade of openness. And traditionally, it's been people who are high in the trade of openness are more likely to be like open about gays and more likely to be anti-racist. But I think it's interesting. So like I call it the five personality type quiz, or the Myers-Briggs type, like how that influences like your political persuasion is really interesting to me.
No, I fully agree with what you're saying. So I think, yeah, traditionally conservatives are high in conscientiousness, but low in openness. And they also tend to be low in neuroticism, right? Whereas liberals tend to be very high in openness, but very low in conscientiousness and higher in neuroticism.
High in openness and high in neuroticism.
And yeah, you are?
High in openness, high in neuroticism, medium in conscientiousness, low in extroversion, let's see, which is, I think I'm missing one
of them. Agreeableness is the other
one. Low in agreeableness. Actually, though I was maybe more agreeable when I was younger, but I'm generally low in agreeableness. And then medium in conscientiousness.
Yeah, that sounds, I'm very low in conscientiousness and very low in agreeableness, very high in openness, relatively high in extroversion. And I think, you know, it's interesting. I think that what you were saying about being more open towards gays and other races, like, in a weird way, I think the alt-right actually was. Like, we were sort of in a formalist sense to the right of mainstream conservatives. But I think that the, like, this is a radical thing I'm about to say, but I think that the median alt-righter was actually less racist than the median just normie conservative in terms of just their visceral impulse, like, when they interact with the
mainstream. I think once you talk honestly and directly about these issues, you can respect outgroups. The problem is, I think colorblindness leads to a lot of under-the-ground implicit racism. So when the woke talk about implicit bias, they're actually correct. I think colorblindness suppressing these subconscious biases leads to a lot of implicit racism, which leads to much more harmful policies and worse relations. I think once you can be honest and talk openly, then you actually can respect outgroups and grant them their agency.
Absolutely. I fully agree with what you're saying. And I think that colorblindness is one of the most just repulsive political impulses in America, because it really does just obfuscate issues. It's an obscurantism is what it is. And
it's responsible for the worst of the left and the right, because on the left, when it comes to the whole debate about like wokeness and racial inequities, if you're a blank slatist, then basically you have only two options. Either you do forced equity, or you basically, if you're a blank slatist, these are the only two options: either total forced equity, or you go the full on kind of like everyone has to pull themselves up from their bootstraps argument. And come up with like good arguments and good policy, you need to be honest about like hereditarianism.
No, absolutely. And I would argue that the normie conservative colorblind mindset is way like more mean towards black people than just believing in HPD, right? Because if you're someone like me who just believes that like it's going to be a very small proportion.
They view it as a moral. The thing is, they view it as a moral failing. So that's actually much harsher.
Well, right. Yeah. But see, the problem is it's almost like a miscommunication, because I think for a lot of liberals, intelligence is the same thing as like moral worth. Right. And so like if for an HBD person, when we say that like, okay, blacks on average have an average IQ, like a standard deviation lower than whites, like liberals view that as the same thing as like the content of your character. Right. Because for them, like they're morally superior to conservatives because they're smarter than them. And like if you think about it, like the conservative mindset is you get your morality from church every weekend. So like you're following kind of these prescribed rules. So like intelligence doesn't have that much to do with that. Whereas for liberals, intelligence is, you know, like going to sort of curtail your ability to, you know, like read philosophy and work, do self-help stuff or meditate. I mean, like being interested in that kind of stuff tends to be associated with IQ, being self-reflective, being introspective. So I think for a liberal, when they, you know, like it's a much more existentialist conception of morality. So when they hear that intelligence isn't evenly distributed across the population, like for them, that's kind of terrifying, because they are sort of the ones who would support a eugenicist platform, you know, if they were to accept that premise, right? Whereas conservatives are less likely to go in that direction. So I think that's sort of like the underlying fault line here that makes it really hard. I guess I've sort of adopted a view, like you don't have to talk about HPD with everybody. You should talk about it with the people who are open enough to talk about it. But like you can sort of use proxies, right, with people who won't talk about it with you. But I think that like everybody who needs to be aware of it is aware of it at this point. And that's why that article that you had published that was citing Emil Kierkegaard's study about like race and IQ being the most controversial thing in America right now. I forget what it was called. But basically like this study that you had cited indicated that it was like more controversial to talk about race and IQ than saying that like pedophilia isn't harmful. And I just don't believe that.
Yeah,
like,
I wrote about that, but I found that I was pretty shocked. Like I find that kind of hard to believe, but
I mean, it's look at the methodology of that
study.
I guess
one critique of the study in the article is it didn't ask their personal opinion, whether it's their personal opinion or whether they think that's what society considers taboo. But it did show actually that liberals are more moralistic than conservatives, but that the taboos were not widely different between liberals and conservatives. They both generally share the same taboos.
Because, okay, when it comes to race and IQ, now again, I live in Florida, so, you know, the rules might be different. But, you know, I'll go on dates with liberal women, and I'll talk to them about race and IQ, and they'll go like, okay, right? I mean, like, I'll talk to, like, coworkers about this kind of stuff, and they'll just be, like, fine with it. You know, like, it's only when talking to people who specifically, like, live in the Northeast or something that, you know, I encounter, like, a big problem. Now, again, I've sort of created an incentive structure around myself. I've created a sort of bubble where I might be insulated from the worst of this. And, you know, as somebody who's in academia, somebody who's in working for the government, I can understand if it's different for you. But I just know, I'm 100% confident that for any given person that I speak to, it would be more controversial for me to say that pedophilia is not harmful than for me to say that, that blacks have a lower average IQ than whites. Like, I am absolutely certain that the vast majority... There's nobody who thinks that, like, pedophilia is like, better than race and IQ. Like, that's so fucking retarded. I'm sorry. Like, I need to figure out how the study produced this.
There's one other thing that probably is true with more taboo. Well, hereditarianism is more taboo than anti-Semitism now, which actually, that would have shocked me 5 years ago, but now that actually makes sense.
That would have shocked me a year ago. But, yeah. It's actually really weird. It is allowing us to discuss the Jewish question in a way that's like honest, but also isn't, I don't know, like cucky, and also isn't, I guess, like too crass and too conspiratorial. Like, it actually is allowing us to draw a much more nuanced view on the.
What's happening with these left wing protests, in a sense, the one good thing coming from them is that they're helping expand the Overton window.
True. Yeah. True. And, like, they allow us to take a sort of centrist position on the JQ that, like, I think that both you and I, like, it's because there are plenty of, like, based, like, pro-white Jews, right? Like, there always have been. And, like, I think guys like you and I would always be, like, you know, we'd want to include them in whatever coalition we do. And, like, we'd be very hostile to these, like, anti-Semites who just want to drive them out just because they're Jewish. But it's also, like, you know, we do want to talk about, like, you know, people like Barbara Lerner Specter, or, you know, all of the horrible neocons from, like, the Ron Paul era. Like there should be room to talk about, like, there was a certain paranoia.
And they're allowing the really extreme, crazy, like, left-wing anti-Semitism is allowing for us to be the centrist, basically.
Exactly. Oh, I fucking love it, because this is what I've been, like, longing for my entire life. You know, I mean, on a lot of issues, I think we can sort of take that centrist position that, you know, like, we can be the moderate ones, you know, for once. And, I think we're really lucky to be on Substack right now, because this is a great sort of environment. You probably just noticed, like, the sort of viewership on Substack is so much better than Twitter or YouTube or anywhere else.
For sure. So we talk about, like, a lot of these themes that transcend left versus right. So can you kind of explain which issues where you're more liberal, and what are the fundamental issues? Would you say you're fundamentally right wing? Because you say the Walt right. So is it primarily just that you believe in hierarchy?
Yeah, so there's a few things. Yeah, so when I say right wing versus left wing, I think there's a few things that come to mind. Number one is hierarchy, as you said. I believe in there's certain natural hierarchies that emerge. And then there's also sort of artificial hierarchies that are sort of imposed by the left in an attempt to level off those natural hierarchies. And I think that the natural hierarchies are more virtuous because they're more honest. They're more straightforward about being self-interested. Whereas I think that the left-wing hierarchies, the sort of bureaucracies, the sort of DEI initiatives, you know, whatever, academia, all of these hierarchies tend to be, I mean, like, they're just as hierarchical, right? They're just as, like, sort of authoritarian, but they're not honest about that, and they're not honest about being self-interested. They pretend to be much more altruistic than they really are, and that's what's scary about them, because they promote this kind of doublespeak, right? And they promote just, like, this constant culture of lying about shit, and they sort of feminine communicative norms where you sort of disguise power in the language of consensus, which I really despise. So I would say that that's one respect in which I'm right-wing. I'm also right-wing in the sense that I support differentiation. So I think that there's a certain homogenizing impulse to the left where they want everyone to be the same, where they want everyone to, and, you know, especially as a right-wing artist, this is something that's sort of important to me, is I'm really big on people being different and people sort of leaning into their differentness, right? And that's why I sort of am sort of a right-wing multiculturalist. I have that sort of, like, Alexander the Great impulse, the sort of Roman Empire impulse of, like, let's all be racist, but also multicultural together in a big, you know, It's like a almost like a Justice League is how I could conceive America. You know, I want like white people to sort of be the Superman in that, but you know, like we'll also respect everyone else in our coalition and we'll bring them. You know, like it's entirely justified for them to take a self-interested and transactional approach to politics in the same way we will. And I want us all to just like negotiate and collaborate in a big coalition. So that's kind of my approach there. I would say that I'm a vitalist, right? So I support vitality. I support sort of feeling pain as a way to like reset your hedonic treadmill. Because if you only are comfortable and if you're only experiencing pleasure, it sort of makes it so that like even getting out of bed is hard, right? Because like you're used to so much pleasure that all you want to do is like eat and sleep and come and like it turns you into a total degenerate. And I'm still like sex positive, and I'm sort of an Epicurean. Like I believe in like, you know, enjoying good things, nice things. I like luxury, but I want there to be a certain amount of hardship and struggle and especially conflict in the world. I think that makes everything else meaningful. And I think that struggle and conflict and strife, that's another reason I'm very right wing, is that I view these things as good in and of themselves. I think that like fighting with people is just inherently a good thing. It's iron honing iron, right? And it makes you better to be constantly tested. And I believe competition is inherently very good. So these are all the reasons I consider myself right wing. Oh, and the other one is I'm sort of heteronormative, right? I believe in like the boy-girl romance and sex is like a good thing that should be promoted by society, by the state. You know, I'm not like anti-gay.
No BAP, Bronze Age Pervert, Handsome Thursdays.
No. I found that thing kind of repulsive. Like I don't like the idea that men should be judged by their looks. I think that that's very dangerous for society because most men, like men didn't evolve to be beautiful. We evolved to be functional, right? And the idea of like sort of like prizing male beauty too much is very repulsive to me. So I'm sort of against that's like the main reason I'm against BAPism. Now look, if you want to be a bodybuilder or whatever, like fine, but I do just think it's kind of gay. Like to me, I was into powerlifting when I was younger, and I sort of think prizing function over everything else should sort of be the mindset for men. Whereas for women, I mean, I think, you know, prizing beauty is fine. So I guess that's my general mindset. I think I have just like general, like a support of patriarchy. Like I don't believe that most people are purely agentic. I don't really believe in like a thick notion of free will. I think that like it's better for people to believe they have free will. And that's why conservatives are like more hardworking than liberals, right? Because they tend to be less sort of fatalistic. They tend to, you know, have more of a libertarian idea of free will. However, I think that like elites in society need to sort of structure the incentive structure that everybody's inhabiting in order to encourage greater agency in the populace, number one, but also to just ensure that our incentives are aligned with the most pro-social outcomes. So those are the respects in which I conceive of myself as right wing. In terms of policy by policy, I say my left wing policies, everything that I say is like left wing. I think of it as like right wing, but like people just, it's coded as left wing. So like abortion, for instance, I think it's right wing to support abortion because I mean, number one, look at who's actually getting abortions. that's all I'll say. I will say I'm against like abortion in like the eighth month or in like the third trimester. Like I think that's obviously like gross and terrible and bad. It's, you know, it's sort of like sacrificing babies to Baal or whatever. But I think that
an abortion centrist is reasonable.
Yeah, like the problem is that like ever since Roe versus Wade was repealed, it's like it's sort of polarized most Americans into supporting abortion up to the point of birth because they're so mad at Republicans for, you know, like just taking this pro-life maximalist stance. And it sort of just makes me think conservatives are retarded. And I wrote an article about this called Pro-Lifers Are Murdering Babies, where I was basically saying like, look, like the average like woman, even like feminists, like didn't support abortion in like the ninth month, right? Like until a few years ago, it was because of Roe v. Wade that they took this like this very intransigent, like maximalist pro-choice stance. And they wouldn't have felt that way. Like, so all these pro-lifers were supporting all these like extreme, you know, measures, like six week bans or whatever. It's like, look, like when you do that, you're going to get babies killed, right? Because you're going to get people supporting abortion up to the point of birth who otherwise wouldn't have. And that's going to result practically in hundreds of thousands of babies being killed in the womb. And it's your fucking fault. It's your fault for being a maximalist. And for
yeah, and I think even like on gay issues, there can be a centrist middle ground too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I'm like, I don't really care that much about gay marriage at this point because I feel like marriage has been so degraded as an institution. But like, it's like, let him have it, right? It's like,
yeah, exactly. I'd say like on those issues that you went over. So on the issue of vitalism, I mostly agree, but I leave room for pluralism because different things work for different people, different archetypes. On the issue of differentiation, like I'm a right-wing multiculturalist. So I believe in distinction, and it also comes from, I also share like the artistic background. So when I think about like visual art and painting, like distinction is very important, but like being right-wing multiculturalism is about like wanting to preserve distinction and opposing the mass homogenization. And then, yeah, like I believe hierarchy is inherent in nature and can be a good thing, and we'll leave some room for nuance, which you could say is like a radical center, is extreme disparities in power extreme inequality tend to lead to destabilization, resentment, and abuse of power. So
yes.
I'll leave some room for nuance there. So I guess to say I'm a radical centrist, but maybe sometimes I might say like I'm right-wing philosophically, but progressive on certain policy issues.
It's interesting. You mentioned like the inequality that it can create. I think that it's like, you know, you look at the Roman Empire or the, I guess the late
capitalism, where I'm sort of a leftist is I believe the hierarchy is inherent to nature. And thus it's because it's natural, it's not something dirty. But I agree with leftists that capitalism, obviously along with technological progress, exacerbates the hierarchy that is inherent in nature.
Well, yes, right? And I think that we've seen several occasions throughout history where you had a sort of entrenched elite that was getting too powerful relative to the rest of society.
I mean, you can even make the case for like what dating apps are doing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, we should definitely talk about
that. Capitalism in general.
Well, yeah, but what I was going to say was I think that in the Gilded Age, right, like the robber barons having control of the railroads were so important for like the overall infrastructure back then. It's like you needed to like split up, you know, like you needed antitrust laws for something like that. And I think the same thing with AI. Like I don't want I don't want like OpenAI being like the one company that is on the cutting edge, right? That's like scary as shit. It's too important.
Economically, I'm not really a capitalist. I'm not a socialist or Marxist, but I'm more sympathetic to something like distributism. Like I would even say I'm kind of a distributist. My just one critique of distributism is that they lack a strong enough response to how to adapt to AI and technological progress, because they tend to be these like older kind of tradcath like Luddites. But I'm basically a distributist. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. Maybe you should be a distributive futurist and come up with
a way. One of my upcoming articles is like fully automated luxury distributism or like distributist futurism.
That would be really interesting for me to read, because I've always thought of distributism in just an inherently sort of like backwards looking philosophy. And I've always sort of dismissed it for that reason. But I would be really interested to hear your take.
It kind of is. It's right. But at the same time, you're also right. They tend to be like these Luddites. Even if Tucker Carlson's very much, he wants to slow down AI, but if you want to accomplish like nationalist objectives of immigration restriction and onshoring of jobs, then you actually do have to embrace some degree of automation. You can't be a Luddite.
I mean, if you just look at our agricultural industry, I mean, I'm sorry, you're not going to get white people. I mean, you as a Californian probably know this, right? I mean, like there's... It's going to be very hard to like replace illegal immigrants with white people. I mean, you really need robots.
I think long term, the solution is automation, and this is going to probably turn off a lot of people on the right. But actually, I mean, short term, I would support some kind of like, I don't support like a full blown amnesty, but some kind of special arrangement where people who are undocumented or illegal working in the agricultural industry can stay at least for the time being to work in jobs where it is very hard to get Americans. So there is, I actually have some like nuance on illegal immigration.
I think it would be really easy to sell if you just say, okay,
long-term. Yeah. Like long-term it's all good. Yeah. They're not allowed to vote, but like long-term it's all going to be automated.
Like I say, we just do a grand bargain. Like they all have like permanent legal status, but they never, ever, ever get the right to vote. And I think as long as we do that and their kids don't get the right to vote, you know, if we could somehow come up with like a grand bargain like that, I think most right wingers would be okay with it. Cause I think the concern more than anything is that they're just going to all vote blue. But I think that in Florida, in Texas, you know, there's not a concern anymore because we see them voting red. But I think in California and Arizona and Colorado, it's just like, they still vote so heavily blue. We need to do something. And I don't want, I mean, I guess California is already kind of lost. I mean, will California ever be red again? Or do you think like, is there any way to turn it?
I think not under the current paradigm shift, but I think if someone who's really talented can come up with a unique ideological framework specifically for California, then that could have an impact, but not under the current existing political paradigm. I want to ask you, I wanted to bring up, like, you do actually do have a short platform for the new right or the walt right. And what you call for is intellectual rigor and disdain for obscurantism and grifting, free speech and a resistance to feminine communication norms and politics, youthful vitalism and a push to dismantle gerontocracy, a cosmopolitan rejection of isolationism in favor of a Kissingerian, a Jacksonian foreign policy of imperial self-interest, a civic-minded determination to reform the American elite from within, and a new right-wing urbanism that seeks to break the mental association in America between conservatism and the automobile. I think the last part about, like, a right-wing urbanism, that part is especially interests me.
Yeah, I think that you know, it's interesting. Like, every now and then you get an impulse in America to, like, start building trains and everything. And then it always tends to be, you know, we actually did something in Florida recently. There's now a high-speed rail or a semi, you know, I think it might be considered like a medium speed. I don't know. But, like, between Miami and Orlando, that's, like, pretty decent. So, you know, we got something. But, like, you guys were trying to build something between San Francisco and L.A., right? And it never...
Yeah, it's a total failure. And the thing is, the problem is really corruption, but because of the corruption, then conservatives will say, oh, got you. Like, because liberals failed, they take a totally reactionary approach. Well, actually, not entirely, because Florida is doing their own high-speed rail, but the problem is conservatives are fundamentally reactionary, so they'll point to any liberal failure of something. So it's like, same with multiculturalism. Instead of promoting right-wing multiculturalism, they'll reject multiculturalism, or instead of the failures of left-wing socialism, they'll be for a knee-jerk right-wing capitalism instead of offering maybe some aspects of socialism that work better. They're just purely reactionary thinkers. They just do the total opposite of how they perceive their opponents as doing, instead of trying to create a better, superior version of it.
I think a big problem when it comes to high-speed rail in particular has always been NIMBYs. You know, because, like, you have to rely on eminent domain. And I think, I mean, California has had a problem with NIMBYs in particular for so long. But it's interesting that both Gavin Newsom and Ron DeSantis are both kind of YIMBY, right? So, I mean, I do think the younger generation of, like, Gen X.
Things are really shifting on that issue. California has been super NIMBY. And the NIMBY movement, what's interesting is, they're right about the fundamental issue of increasing the housing supply, but they're also very much about, like, racial leftism. So they talk a lot about, like, integrating, using YIMBY policies to integrate white communities and make them more diverse. Like, they're very left-coded.
Well, see, here's the thing is, I think that, like, a lot of them, like, Matt Iglesias doesn't like when they do that, right? Like, his thing is, you should sell YIMBYism to people wherever they are. And because a lot of right-wing NIMBYs are against it for precisely that reason. Right. So I think a lot of even on the left, YIMBYs, like, don't like sort of framing it in that way, because they view it as turning off too many people. And because the thing is, YIMBYism doesn't have to be anti-white.
It should be pluralist. It should be conditional, each community's specific needs. But then that's what I would promote. But then they would say, I'm not really a YIMBY. They're too much of, like, one size fits all solutions.
So what I would say, like, the way I sell it to right wingers is say, you know, don't you want your kids to be able to live in your own neighborhood? Right. Don't you want your kids to be able to buy a house in the neighborhood where they grew up? Right. And maybe it's a condo, maybe it's a townhouse starting out, but, like, you know, maybe you get things a little denser. But hey, if you develop your neighborhood and you get it denser, then you can sell your house or maybe give your house to your kid.
I promote that. Like, I talk about, like, a fusion of YIMBYism and enclavism. So I would promote that 100%, but you would need some kind of total legal paradigm shift, including, like, freedom of association for that to work.
Oh, for, like, restricted covenants and stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, so it would be each community builds for its own needs. Like, ideally, that should be the case. But I guess the question, let's just say we're not allowed freedom of association. We have, like, the existing civil rights legislation. So let's just say we accept that. Then what is, like, the perfect kind of Goldilocks zone on the YIMBY versus NIMBY debate if we're not allowed freedom of association?
I think, honestly, now, look, I'm biased because I'm someone who I don't, like, I've never been, like, attached to the land, so to speak. I'm someone who just, I think it's, like, good to move around, to, like, pursue opportunities as they are. So for me, it's, like, it's natural that, you know, old people, you know, maybe they're living in a suburb that's been developed a lot, and, like, they can just, like, sell their home and then go, you know, especially because when you're older, it's like you can just go get a condo or get like a smaller place. And like, why do you need a big house anymore? But that's just sort of my attitude. I mean, obviously some old people want to stay living in a big house, or they'll be like sentimental about like, you know, and they don't want to see the neighborhood change.
Or there's also like tax incentives, because like one thing I've noticed about California is a lot of the wealthy areas, like the average age, in your typical like upper class white suburban area in California, I think your average age is something like 58.
Maybe there should be a specific, there should be a huge tax write-off for if you're willing to sell your home and like move out to like an old people community, right?
The thing is, California passed something, a proposition like that, and I don't even think it's had a dramatic. Well, as people to keep their property, their low property tax exemptions, but I don't think it's had that dramatic of an impact, actually.
I mean, maybe just encouraging more like old people in states like California to just move to like, you know, play. I mean, I hate to sell out Arizona again, but like Arizona is a great state for retirees, right? So like you could relieve some pressure on the housing market that way by just, you know, getting them less like fiercely protective of their neighborhood or whatever. Cause I do think maybe opening up more land in like, Montana and stuff, like developing new communities out there specifically for retirees with like federal.
Or even just build like new retirement communities in California.
I guess there's probably still a bunch of open land, right? I mean.
But I guess the thing is, they wouldn't, it depends where it is.
I just don't understand.
Because like the coastal area is really sought after and there's limits on growth and everyone wants to live by the coast.
Can you imagine if there were like no, like building restrictions in LA, like
I am sort of more of a NIMBY when it comes to protecting like the open space wilderness in California. Like on that issue, I'm more of a NIMBY about open space and especially places that are really scenic, but I actually wouldn't mind like the coastal part of LA being more like Miami, like in Santa Monica, Venice Beach.
Yeah. I mean, like the amount of tax revenue you can get there. The thing is, it would probably depopulate a lot of the country's interior, right? Because I think if everyone could move to California and they could get an affordable apartment right on the coast of LA, like imagine if you just developed it like parts of like China or Japan, right? I mean, if it were like Tokyo, you could like easily get like 100 million people just in LA.
Someone said that on Twitter. I'm trying to think. Was it? Did you write that?
No, that was VB Knives.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's right.
I love that guy, but I'm trying to get his attention, but he hasn't seen me yet. So
I like him, but sometimes he's not the most responsive. But he's excellent.
No, he has some great takes on stuff. Yeah, no, I think that like, see, that's the thing though, is that like, I think that a lot of the reason the NIMBY problem exists is because you probably do have certain elites that cater to interests in the Midwest that are sort of like obscure, right?
Would be a way to sort of like brain drain a lot of the upper class of the Midwest.
Yeah, and well, that's the
like,
thing.
I actually wrote an article about 2 years ago that says, are NIMBYs responsible for California's great replacement? So, like, if California went more YIMBY, it would be more diverse, but numerically, you probably would, like, bring back more white people. I wrote another article that went viral that got a lot of, it was overtly satirical. But it really pissed off a lot of like left wing housing advocates, even though it's like so over the top satirical. But it was called the YIMBY to alt right pipeline, and like I used the word vertical Lebensraum, which is it's.
I love that. No, I love. I see. I don't get this whole like right wing opposition to living in a bug pod because I love living in a bug pod.
That hostility was from left-wing anti-gentrification activists on Twitter.
You know, gentrification is something I believe that's the future for the right. I think we need to go into, we need to get a bunch of, like, you get a bunch of upper middle class.
Because the thing is, everything about the right, anti-immigration and white flight, they're two big things. Anti-immigration and white flight are reactionary and they're focused on slowing down negative change. I like the idea of, like, starting over and thinking positive in the way, like, that a new immigrant diaspora would. So you're going into a community and you're kind of starting over from scratch. And psychologically it's healthy because it changes your mindset from instead of slowing down negative change to something that's more optimistic.
Well, gentrification is kind of like colonization in a way, right?
It is.
It's sort of like our ancestors would go out to like a harsh, I mean, and a lot of them got, like people forget, like a lot of the pilgrims and stuff, they died, right? And like Jamestown and stuff, like a lot of them just fucking died. But I mean, it was a harsh way of life. But if you survived, you got to get like this giant like chunk of farmland, right? Like, it was like virgin territory. And a lot of it was already sort of cleared and developed because the Indians like died of smallpox or whatever. And they, so like a lot of the, they just like left all this empty land that was already like the forests had been cleared and like the swamps had been drained. So, you know, like we could just go in and start these massive farms. And it was really great. I feel like gentrification could offer the same thing. You know, you just, especially if you're a young guy, like a single guy in your early 20s, if you have a decent job, why the hell not? Right. Just go in, get a house in the ghetto, 8 years, you know, some like gay artist or whatever, or some professionals want to buy it. Like, there you go. And then you're fine.
I also think that the limousine liberal who lives in like an all white community while also taking part in multiculturalism, like you can say that's exploitative or hypocritical, but I'd actually say like they're better adapted to this kind of healthy dualism where you have your own area and you take part in multiculturalism as opposed to right wing thinker people who lack any sense of like dualism in their thinking.
The thing is,
in their way of living.
Like that's what I'm trying to build is the sort of like high openness right. Right. And that's what I because you saw that in the alt-right in the early days. And this kind of takes us back to something we were discussing earlier in terms of temperament. Like, yeah, the early cohort of the alt-right was very high openness, very smart guys. Almost everybody was above 120 IQ. Almost everybody was intellectually generative. Either they made content or, you know, the comments they posted were very big brained. And there was more of a culture of like different publications allowing like they had open comment section back then. Right. So you had people who would like write these long intricate comments on the, you know, various websites. But since then, I mean, I think the problem was like the alt-right became too attractive and we sort of started attracting more sort of heritage conservatives, people who grew up, because a lot of us had grown up in liberal families or even if we grew up in a conservative family, we had sort of become more culturally liberal ourselves. And, you know, we were very educated oftentimes in the arts or humanities. Whereas like this new cohort who came in 2016, it was around the time Trump won the nomination. I was just much smaller braid, much more chuddish, you know, and a lot of these guys, the sort of types who just didn't get why Richard Spencer was cool. Right. Like the sort of types who like didn't get why we liked him. Like they didn't get.
Yeah, they're the people who called us like queers in high school.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, that's
the. It was sort of like, I think the original scene was high IQ, a mixture of high IQ nerds, but also more artistic, creative types.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think I'm kind of in the middle between those different types. You seem kind of like the same. You seem kind of like an artsy sort of guy, are you?
Yeah, I have a background in like visual arts.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
The thing is, like, but conservatives—they're total, like they are Philistines about culture. And there's a whole meme like, why can't the right make quality art? And they tend to be like overtly political about art.
Right. Yeah. Like, so I wrote that article about that, why conservatives suck at art, and it's like, you know, the prototypical example is like a Hallmark movie or like God's Not Dead. Right.
Right.
Right. You know, like you always have some like black guy singing about Jesus at the end. It's like very cringe. But I mean, I think the problem is when the left makes art, they're not trying to make. Like only the really shitty ones are like trying to overtly put out like a leftist message. Most of the time they're trying to just like create art that speaks to them and it'll just sort of subtly reflect a leftist worldview. Sometimes not
but
just
someone, right. I think like some of the best filmmakers like David Lynch, it's a very intuitive experience, but they like someone like David Lynch, he refuses to tell people like what it means. He just wants each person to have like their own intuitive experience of his work and his art.
Yeah. And, I think something interesting too is that when we think of like the best conservative art, a lot of times it's made by liberals who just like want to have a very, who are either like very disagreeable and they're sort of like dissatisfied with the way other liberals will sort of depict the world. They don't think it's accurate enough. Like you think of like Lena Dunham, remember Girls?
Oh, right.
That's a very conservative show. Right? Because it's not like Sex in the City.
I think the right hated it at the time, but now there's this newfound appreciation for it on the right.
Yeah, another one is The Sopranos, which, like, it's funny. If you watch it superficially, like, as a young liberal, you'll think Tony's, like, a bad racist for, like, being mean to Meadows' boyfriend. But then when you watch it when you're older, you realize that, like, they're trying to say that Meadows' boyfriend is just as much of a sort of misogynist or whatever as Tony. And, like you know, the half-black, half-Jewish guy, right? Right. He takes advantage of her. He takes her virginity and then dumps her because she's, like, distracting him with his schoolwork or whatever, right? And like in a sense, like that's actually it sort of like vindicates Tony's view from like a sort of, you know, oblique way. A lot of that, like, because if they were to make The Sopranos these days, they would have had like Tony be like told off by the guy in a much more like straightforward way, right? Or they wouldn't have made that guy take advantage of Meadow. But I think they it was important for them to depict the world in like a realistic way that didn't have like good guys and bad guys, right? I mean, like of course he said that Tony Soprano was terrible and he sort of resented his fans for liking him, but at the same time, I mean, he didn't like he made Tony cool, right? And like they leaned into the fact that Tony Soprano was cool. Like they didn't try to like make him out to be a loser. That
yeah,
was sort of
so
the
like
point
they're right, stuff. they're overly political, they lack nuance. But I think the other thing is like what defines the mainstream right. It's long been a coalition of moral conservatives and capitalists. Like aesthetics and beauty should be a political principle, but it's actually not on either side.
You do get like sort of artists though who are very coded as right wing, like Lana Del Rey.
Right. Are you? I mean, do you have like? I can't think of a specific example off the top of my head, but people who are kind of who are vaguely liberal, but they're right wing in the sense of how they're artistically and aesthetically elitist.
Yeah, I agree with that. I see a lot of people like that specifically in my community, or even like even if they're not, even people who aren't necessarily artsy, just people who have that sort of instinct for differentiation and for extreme honesty, and who like enjoy combat, right? Like there are a lot of people who are like sort of...
painting is sort of a metaphor for ethnopluralism because the beauty and the diversity of the different colors and contrast is what makes a painting beautiful. But you don't want to mix all the paints together. You want to have them next to each other, but the differentiation in the color palette.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that like there's always been a history of that in our civilization, right? I mean, there's always been an appreciation for taking elements from other civilizations and adding them to your own in order to make it more vital, more robust. And it seems like a lot of white nationalists want to make us into like Tokugawa Japan.
They're not opposed to that, but I think like example of Van Gogh or Van Gogh, like borrowing from like the Japanese and a lot of great examples of that. I think it's a great thing. I don't like the idea that like I'm generally like pro Western, pro European, but I don't like the idea of creating like a totally stagnant culture that purges all outside influences.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let me ask you, since we're talking about art, how do you feel about AI art?
I've considered both arguments. I think it's interesting. It is sort of like a Jungian collective consciousness, which is interesting. But I guess the argument that it will replace artists, I've thought about that. But I've considered both sides. But I think when I read your article against gatekeeping, I sort of considered both sides. I was on the fence, but I decided that gatekeeping is bad for innovation because it still needs... It's not like, I don't, because a lot of AI art sucks because the people making it sucks. I think a great person who's a great artist can also make great AI art. So I'm actually fine with it. I've came to that conclusion. I think gatekeeping is bad for creative innovation.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I fully agree with you. It depends on the skill of the person who's doing it. And like when I'm using a tool like Suno or DALL-E or something, there's a way to do it that's very lazy. Right. Where you can produce something that's like, this works. And sometimes I've done that for like one or two of my songs or one or two of my thumbnails or whatever. Cause I didn't have the time to, you know, but like when you're really spending a good hour or two, you know.
Okay, so all your intro songs are AI.
Yes. Yes. isn't that crazy?
Yeah. I want to actually like, this is a little bit off topic, but I want to revisit your Disney videos because I think that's interesting. Because it really relates to like millennial nostalgia. I think I've like all these different movies that you reference. Let me think, see which movies you reference, like Mulan, Little Mermaid, Swan Princess.
Mostly 90s stuff.
Like mostly 90s. I think I remember seeing just about every one of those as a kid in theaters.
Mm-hmm. That's why it was effective. That's why I was so big among millennials, right? It's because like there's that inherent, you know what reminds me of is like Hamilton. Like Lin-Manuel Miranda used a lot of hip-hop conventions to explain, like, American history to, like, black people and teenage girls, right? So, like, you know, like, the sort of, like thug, like, rap battle culture, like, he used that to explain, like, dueling or the, you know, the tensions between, like, Hamilton and Jefferson in the first cabinet, in Washington's cabinet. I did something similar. I used, like, the sort of dynamics of all the Disney movies we grew up with, like, the thematic dynamics to explain things in like the alt-right. So for instance, like my song Fall in Line, I had the character of Scar, who in the movie is like leading all these hyenas as like a sort of populist demagogue saying, you know, I'm going to take control and you'll never be hungry again. Which, by the way, you know, in The Lion King, Mufasa was kind of a bad ruler. He was just letting this, like, letting all the hyenas starve on the edges of his kingdom. Like, that actually shows he wasn't very, like, forward-thinking, right? Like, in that context, I'm able to use that sort of paradigm, that sort of, like, thematic dynamic to in my song, Fall in Line, you have George Soros as Scar. And he's speaking to Black Lives Matter, who are the hyenas. And he's saying,
I think you do have there is a BitChute account of your videos, but I don't think that one is up. I haven't seen that one at all. I've actually been binge watching your videos before the show, but I couldn't find that one.
All of my videos are up on the Murdoch website. You can find them there, but I'm probably going to just post them on my Substack at some point. You can find it on the Murdoch website because those guys were kind enough to save them there. But so Fall in Line, that was actually one where I was sort of criticized recently by Tracing Woodgrains. I went on a rationalist podcast with him it was a website called The Mott, and I was being sort of interrogated by him and another rationalist.
Oh, I listened to that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, they were mad about that one because they were saying,
"I'm surprised they're not mad about the Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs," which was obviously satirical, but pretty over the top anti-Semitic.
Well, that one's way more offensive. Yeah, I mean, well, that one's just kind of
thing
so
is, it's like so over the top.
Yeah, it's so dumb that I don't think anyone would get offended by it, right? I mean, Fall in Line actually is intelligent, right? It's actually like it's a well done video that I think a lot of people would like. It's almost more offensive because it's making a good point. But the thing is, it's like, I still stand by the message of that video insofar as George Soros did see white people as kind of like an enemy, and he was trying to mobilize a sort of a subaltern, a resentful subaltern ethnic group.
The hyenas represent the sub-ethnic group.
Well, they represent Black Lives Matter specifically because it's supposed to be about the Ferguson riots. Yeah. Cause this was 2015. I was making a sense. So, I mean, it was, I don't really disavow that per se. I guess if anyone gets their feelings hurt I don't think anyone would get their feelings hurt is a thing.
Again, it's like so over the top satirical.
Yeah. And I feel like it's actually like flattering towards Jews, but also like sort of, it's like not mean towards Black people necessarily. Like it sort of like gets where they're coming from because it's saying they're sort of being taken advantage of. So I don't think it's that offensive, but anyway. So I mean, like some people are going to get, you know, be pissy about that kind of stuff, but I don't think it's a big deal. But anyway. I forgot what were we talking about? The Disney parodies.
It is. It really relates to millennial nostalgia. So I'm somewhat older than you, but I think.
What year were you born?
85. So like the first move, one of the first movies I remember seeing in theaters is Little Mermaid, which came out like Christmas season of 89.
Yeah. Okay.
And then remember Mulan came out, Mulan came out when I was like maybe in sixth grade, I think. And then
because I was like six when Mulan came out.
I think it was in middle school. I forget. Yeah. And then I'm not even sure if Swan Princess is Disney, but I remember seeing that like as like maybe about 8 years old.
Yeah, Swan Princess isn't Disney, but it was like that song was almost perfect for like MRA versus feminist, right?
Oh, right.
So I had to use that.
This is like super autistic, but I'm working on an article about like inversion, and I'm not a musician, so I'm sort of trying to approach it as an outsider. But there's this technique of inversion in music, and I noticed like this Swan Princess song overly relies upon it. But I've noticed, I'm not sure if musicians have a term for it, but the Disney, I think the Little Mermaid song, Wife the Girl, and the Swan Princess anti-feminism song, like they both heavily rely upon this inversion. But I've also noticed it's used a lot in 80s music, and I forget the term.
Key change?
I think it's a chord progression, maybe.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because I wrote an article about the song Planet of the Bass, and it's used in that song. It's heavily used in a lot of 80s music. But I never thought – it's like super autistic to talk about, but I never really thought about it. But then I listened to some video by a music producer about why the Planet of the Bass was successful, and he brings that up. And I'm thinking like most of the songs that I like use that technique. And
it's a very like cheap way of just getting emotional resonance, right? It's almost
it is a cheap way, but like I'm thinking like – most songs that I like use it a lot, and most songs that I dislike don't. But I think for some reason, like, it, I mean, it goes way back to classical music, but for some reason, I think 80s music uses it a lot.
It's a very, it's interesting that you pointed out that a lot of my songs are 37. It's sort of like Broadway. It's like theatrical, right? It's very Broadway. It's very like, you're making it very sort of like,
you're contrasting, it's building up emotion, but it's like,
yeah, it's also like, it's like, it's because in a lot of like Broadway musicals, like
Disney, Disney 90s Disney is super Broadway.
Well, yeah, it was written by Alan Menken and who's the other guy? It was that he died of AIDS anyway, but like, yeah, like they were basically written as like Broadway musicals that are in a movie. Like that's how like the thematic structure is. But I think I think what's interesting is that they say in Broadway musicals, like when it gets too emotional to speak, you start singing, and when it gets too emotional to sing, you start dancing, right? And I think oftentimes like a key change will accompany like when they start dancing, or when they'll just project a progressive, like the final most like impactful verse of the song. Like a key change is a way of like sort of, it's sort of like lights start dancing, right? It's like a way of just like making it the more, it's like progressively upscaling the emotion. It's interesting that you bring that up, because I do think there's
some of them aggressively use them. So of your videos, the Little Mermaid, Wife the Girl, and the Swan Princess anti-feminist song, obviously you're not using it, so you're going by the original, but those are two examples. They overly rely upon that technique. And obviously 80s music uses it a lot too.
Yeah, when we think about 80s music, there's like synthwave, there's a lot of it's interesting. If we think about the shift from the 70s to the 80s, the 70s was very intellectual, it was very subtextual, it was very subdued. You have a lot of beige, you have a lot of like, you know, buildings built back then, you know, they're like gray and beige or whatever, all the suits, you know, were like that. Then you go into the 80s, you get these vibrant colors, you get the synthwave, you get Reagan, you get the action heroes, you get the Rambo, you get the, Red Dawn. And I think there's sort of a, I think it's interesting how the 80s resonates with a lot of millennial guys who were either young children during the 80s or they were like not born yet. Like I was born 3 years after the 80s ended, right? So like for me, but like I love 80s aesthetics, and I love like Miami Vice and Scarface. And I think
sort of like experienced like the very tail end of it. But like right now, like I really hate the whole 2010s, like all gray minimalist aesthetic.
Oh yeah. Same. Wait, it's interesting. Like, because the alt-right was sort of like quasi-80s adjacent, right? I mean, like, with the fast wave, and then, like Richard Spencer was, like, definitely super 80s.
Like, he's, like, the whole, like, karaoke of him singing Depeche Mode.
Yeah, I mean, he just, like, and he, like, leans into it, right? That's his brand. But, like we all, I feel like Jared Taylor's a little 70s. You see what I'm saying?
I associate him more with even though he was just a kid, like, I associate more with the 1950s.
I see him though as being like a 70s detective movie.
Oh, like, right. I can see that. Yeah.
You know, like as I entered into the neighborhood, I noticed that there was a large black woman.
Jared Taylor wrote an article. Like I wrote one article saying like positive things about black people. And I kind of like that dualism. Like you can't have it all like negative. Yeah.
He's such a sweet guy.
Yeah, he is. Like you wrote that article in the case for reparations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I like reading stuff like that, because even if I don't agree 100%, I think you get everything that's so reactionary, so right wing, and even if you disagree, it's good to be provocative, and to even if it's like a thought experiment, like stuff like that's interesting.
Well, just be creative, right? Like show like what possibilities are you know available to us, and I think it's just like. The whole idea of the main reason I wanted to explore it is I like the idea of Ron DeSantis running on something like reparations and then going up on stage and then running like far to like talking about white interests. But because he's saying reparations, no one can really attack him as like anti-black or racist, right? It's like I like exploring how it gives you rhetorical space to go edgier in different directions.
So you're saying your main case for reparations is you think it would actually help expand the Overton window?
Well,
done by like broadly. The right. So obviously, if the Democratic Party did it, it could consolidate.
My whole point is that, like, we have this sort
Would your 2015 self call you a conservative for proposing that?
What do you say? Say that again.
Would your 2015 self call you a conservative for that position?
No, because it's not like if he read the article, he would think it's like weird, but he probably would think it's interesting. Like, because conservative would be like just saying that we need to give reparations because they deserve it or something, right? But like I even say in the article, like we've probably paid them back what they, you know, 20 acres and a mule, like 10 times over through affirmative action and you know, welfare, like through the Great Society or whatever, right? So like it's not that I think that like they deserve it. It's more that I want white people to have the mental infrastructure to resist white guilt in the future. And I think that the way you do that is you get a bunch of black celebrities on TV, like Oprah, Obama, you know, Shaquille O'Neal, whatever, LeBron. You get them all to sign this declaration of absolution, which basically forgives white people formally for slavery and says that like it's even now.
Oh, so it would be conditional.
Yes. Yeah, and you also take away people.
Okay, so I could under the way that's set up, I could support that.
And what you also do is you condition it. You have it pay out as an annuity, right? And you say that you only get reparations if you don't commit any crimes. And so that, like, if you commit a misdemeanor, your account gets frozen for a year. If you commit a felony, it gets taken away permanently. And I think that could be used to restrain black criminality. So I think it's actually, you can create an interesting incentive structure in multiple
dimensions. And like affirmative action would be ended.
Exactly. Yeah. And you use this as a trade. Yeah. Yeah. Right. It's a trade to get rid of affirmative action and to have a harsher carceral state. I think it's a good way to implement that. So.
Do you want to talk about your article on animal rights where you said you support you support animal rights in principle, but you're except for more like effective altruism approach? You didn't really see that issue as being resolved.
No, I here's my thing.
Consumer choices and.
Well, so I used to be a vegan and then I was a vegetarian and then I only ate free range meat for a long time. And then I just, you know, I started going back to eating the Auschwitz meat. And I guess my thing is that like, I'm just too lazy to not, you know, not indulge in factory farm meat, even though I do think it's evil and horrible and everything. And I do feel bad for the animals, but it's just sort of, and I guess I feel like most people are like that. And I think that we basically just need to invest a lot of resources in lab grown meat and then figure out a way to sort of sanitize it in most people's minds so that they don't think of it as like gross cancer or whatever. So, I mean, I think that that's.
Yeah. So DeSantis was wrong for his bill to ban lab grown meat.
Yeah, to me, that was just repulsive. Like, I agree that that was a horrible thing. But, I mean,
it's just an example. And some of it is, like, the big agricultural industry backing him. But part of it is just a culture war, reactionary culture war issue.
Yeah, and I think that really – it honestly didn't, like, sour me on DeSantis when I was really pro-DeSantis before because it did seem like he was just pandering to really stupid fucking people. Because I remember when I was a vegetarian, like you'd encounter people who would just like shove a hamburger in your face just to be a fucking chud asshole. And like, you know, I hate those people. Now, I mean, I do love eating meat today and I will, you know, but it's I do recognize it as unethical and I do think we need to make moves against it. But I mean, at the same time, like,
I mean, I think it could, I'm going to sound like a leftist, but I think people in 100 years could view society today, like on that issue, the way we view people who own slaves in the past.
Of course. Yeah, they definitely will. 100%. I have no doubt on that. I think they're also going to look back on the sex trafficking that goes on to support the porn industry. They're going to look back on like the blood diamonds that go into like, you know, girls' engagement rings. They're going to look back on, you know, the sweatshop labor that goes to produce our cell phones. There's a lot of things we just like kind of.
That's why like if you take part in society, you're responsible for a lot of like moral bads. That's why I take an issue on either the left or the right of like morally condemning people, except for in extreme cases.
Right. I mean, like, if you're an average German person in, like, the third, like, 1940s in Germany, like, all you're thinking about is, oh, man, I hope Stalin doesn't come with his army to, like, rape our women.
Right.
And you're not thinking about the Jews being sent, you know? Or if you're like, a Southern person, you know, like, the average Southern person didn't own slaves. They were probably poor and, like, they were probably, like, living worse than the average slave, right? I mean, a lot of the Scotch-Irish, you know, down there. So, I mean, it's, like, even the slave owners, I mean, it's kind of, like, I don't know, is it that different from having, like, a factory up north where people would be getting caught in the machinery and having their arms, like, torn off and shit with all these, like, Irish immigrants? And I mean, I don't know. Like, to me, it's just, like...
Well, it just is, like, I know it's cliche, like, basic bitch Tucker Carlson talking points, but, like, the whole thing... where people are sanctimonious about racism, but they still have an iPhone where it's made from like cobalt mines in the Congo. Like I know it's like basic bitch kind of Tucker Carlson tier talking points, but it's true.
Well, yeah. I mean, think about the fact that like in the South, right? Like the mass cotton extraction that was supporting the textile mills in Boston that were industrializing the North, right? And the wealth that they had in the North was largely due to this incredibly interconnected economy. I mean, like, first, like, the shipbuilding industries in, like, you know, Rhode Island and everything, like, they had supported the what's it called, the triangle trade for centuries at that point, right? But then, I mean, the Boston textile industry, I mean, like, a lot of the liquor industry, like, a lot of that was deeply interconnected with slave labor. So, not just, like, on the productive side, but on the consumptive side, like, all of the fruits of industrialization that we enjoyed in the North at the time, like, they, you know, were supported by Southern slavery, and most people didn't care about that. And, you know, they only started caring about slavery as a moral issue when slavery started to, most people didn't care about it as a moral issue at all until the very end of the war, number one. And to the extent that they did care about it, I mean, it was mostly because they didn't want Southerners bringing their slaves out west, and they wanted Missouri and Kansas to be for, like, free white settlers. And that was the main reason that we fought a civil war. It wasn't because everyone in the North just wanted to, like, march south and free black people, right? I mean, you know, but we have all this. But then Southerners will say the Civil War wasn't about slavery, and that's also, like, not true. But it's not true in the way that, like, Northerners will say it is, though. So it's like a tricky issue, because, like, there's almost no way to sort of give the true narrative on the Civil War, because both sides will sort of hate you if you do, right? So it's annoying.
One thing that you've said that's really interesting is you have all this, like, self-improvement stuff in, like, the manosphere. And one thing that you said is really interesting is that about the importance is, like, finding a unique niche is really the only solution, but it only works for specific people, especially people with high IQ. The problem that I have, like, well, I have a problem with, I mean, these pill ideologies are totally, they're reductionist and they lack nuance, even though if they give out degrees of truth, whether you're talking about, like, the red pill or the black pill. But I'd say, like, I agree that the pill that I would promote is, like, the specialization pill or find your own unique niche pill.
What I would promote is, yeah, I agree with that. And I think that you need to build a bubble for yourself where the red pill or the black pill isn't true anymore, which is possible to do, right? And that's something that I've sort of done. Like, look, if you become, like, an e-celeb, or if you just get enough money, or if you just get, like, prominent enough in some specific niche, women will give you a lot more leeway, and you don't have to, like, think about holding frame all the time.
I think,
you
know, that's 100% true, but I think it's a niche of guys who are maybe a bit autistic or socially awkward, but they also have a high IQ, or they have a creative or artistic side. Like, I don't think that's going to work for your just average, like, yeah, the lower tier chud types.
Well, the thing is, I don't even know what to tell those guys, because it's like, look, like, if you're smart enough to watch my stuff, you're smart enough to get rich, or you're smart enough to become an e-celeb, and then you'll get women through that, right? But if you're just, like, a guy who has, like, a 105 IQ, and you don't like my videos because, you know, I'm too weird for you or whatever, then it's like, I don't even know how to help that guy like that. So, like, but it's also, like, I don't really care about him. I care about the sort of guys who listen to me, which I know that makes me sound like an asshole, but it's like, look, like, we're not all going to make it. And that's just part of being a man. Right, is like, you just accept, like, everyone who deserves to make it. Well,
I mean, it sounds really harsh, but it's just the reality.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, this is something our ancestors just dealt with over many generations. And if anything, I think that the modern world, like, a lot of people view the modern world as, like, worse or more unfair. Like, a lot of these incels are mad.
Well, I don't think that the modern world is uniquely evil, because people had it pretty rough in the past. I think what I dislike about the modern world is that there is this facade of that there's this lie that we have, like, this kind of Francis Fukuyama utopian end of history, where we've created this perfect egalitarian just society. I don't think our society today is uniquely unjust, but people really resent being gaslighted that we're somehow, like, more fair and evolved.
Well, okay, I think there's multiple dimensions of this. I think that for a guy who is, like, a high IQ autist, like, the modern world is actually better than has, like, ever existed, right? Because I think someone like me, maybe someone like you too, 500 years ago, guys like us might have just been thrown down a well, right? If you're, like, disagreeable and smart, and you're just, like, you know, unless you have a, unless you're, like, someone like Archimedes, right? I mean, he was killed by the Romans, you know, even him. Like, a lot of smart guys, if you're not just born rich, like, and part of the aristocracy that can sort of insulate you, if you're, like, sort of autistic or weird, like, peasants will probably just hate you for being disagreeable, and they might just, like, stone you to death. So, you know, I'm sort of glad I was born in this day and age. I feel like my IQ allows me to get money and women and other things I want in a way that I just couldn't have 500 years ago. So I like, don't want to do the trad thing, because to me, that'll just, like, objectively be worse for someone like me. Now, I think for the average guy who's, like, 105 IQ normie, it probably is a little worse for him, in the sense that, you know, you're not guaranteed a wife anymore, right? I mean, not that you ever were. Like, you were sort of, like, there were always, like, some, I think, like, 15% of men were always, like, incels, even in, like, monogamous times, agricultural times. I think it was higher in the sort of agricultural age and, like Paleolithic times. But then, you know.
It's much higher today than it was just, like, 30 years ago.
I think it's gone from, like, 15%, which is the historical norm, to, like, 30%, which is, like, 30% is way too high. But the thing is, those men are getting, like, a lot of incels are getting absorbed by a lifestyle of porn and video games. Like, in the past, like, when you had so much polygamy that, like, 30% of men became incels, they'd, like, rise up out of, like, you'd see in Muslim societies, right? Like, these, like, Bedouin tribes would rise out of the
desert. Did you see the What If Altus video? You'd probably disagree for that very reason, but did you see What If Altus's video on the coming incel rebellion?
No, I didn't see that, but I
Did you watch him?
I've seen some of his stuff, yeah. He has some interesting takes. I mean, he's a Zoomer, right?
I think he's pretty young, like, maybe. I think he's just, like, 22.
Yeah. No, that's an interesting, I mean, look, I would love it if there were an incel revolt. I think that would be good, but I think these guys are just too weak. They're unagentic. I don't think they have the balls to do it. You know, I wish they did. It will be, because here's the thing, is that the problem is Tinder. And because people blame it on, like, dating apps in the abstract, but, like, look, I mean, you're old enough to remember, like, OkCupid, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Like, OkCupid was, like, good.
Yeah,
back in, like, 2010, like there wasn't, like, the whole incel problem, like, didn't, like, do you remember, like,
there's, like, a chart, and it shows it shot way up, like, right the same exact same year the smartphone was invented.
Yeah. Doesn't surprise me. I mean, I think specifically, though, the adoption of, I mean, I've seen the graph that show when Tinder was, you know, introduced. But because, you know, Tinder was based on the Grindr model, right, which is for gays.
Oh, right.
Right, and Tinder.
And that works for gays, but it doesn't work for straights.
Exactly, right. Because look, most guys are like a six, right? Right? Like, but, like, women don't care that much about looks in real life. But if all you do is give them, like, a swiping app, then they're going to, like, evaluate a man on is his looks, which in real, like, women don't want to do that is the thing. Like, most women don't want to be pumped and dumped by a guy who's just, like, you know, 6'4", you know, which is what's happening right now. But the thing is, if all you give them is a swiping thing, then that's what they're going to do. Whereas something like OkCupid, like, it didn't create incels because it's sort of the way it's structured, it sort of does allow a guy who's just, like, very witty and charismatic but might be, like, a 6 or a 7 to, like, get a girl who's, like, an 8 or a 9, you know. Because most
side is it might be good for a guy who's really good-looking but more very shy might actually benefit from the status quo, who might have struggled in the 0-0s.
No, that's true. But, like, I don't care about those guys. But, I mean, I guess, like, I naturally side with – I mean, I think I'm, like, a moderately handsome guy. But, like, you know, like, I'm not good looking enough to just get pussy on Tinder. Whereas, like, if it's if I can use my body of work, like I do very well with women, like, when I can use, like, my e-celeb status to – I mean, I got my first girlfriend through Walt Bismarck back in the day, right? So, for me, I want guys like me to be able to be successful. So, I guess I'm sort of biased towards something like OkCupid. And I just think Tinder is so convenient and so easy. It's sort of like the vast, I'm not even talking about guys who are super charming or whatever. Like, I just think the vast majority of men are going to do way worse on Tinder than they would on OkCupid. I think that's an incontrovertible statement. Like, unless you are just incredibly good looking, unless you're, like, 6'4" and jacked, you're going to do better on OkCupid than you would on Tinder. And I think that, like, most men should be advocating for Tinder to be banned. Like, I think it's actually a horribly unjust and unethical thing for the average guy. And it's not incels who are getting hurt, right? It's guys who are, like, a 6 or a 7 who have gone from being able to, like,
the same guys who will signal how they'll signal that they're against that.
No, exactly. That's the problem.
That's
the problem.
Irony, yeah.
No, the problem is that it's mid-tier guys who
that's
are the ones.
That's why actually, like, the bottom tier have been pretty placated by porn, but I do think the middle tier being impacted, that could, I don't know how this is going to end up, but that could have some major cataclysmic impacts on society.
No, so this is the thing I was working on early on Substack that I think is huge. It's mid-tier guys are incentivized to pretend that they get laid more on Tinder than they do because they don't want to seem like incels because it's low prestige. And they will never go against Tinder, right? Because it's associated with being like an incel and low prestige to have that position. So they're always going to take the position that, oh, I do fine on Tinder. I don't know what you're talking about. It's like, no, you don't.
It's like I think you say a lot in your podcast, any complaint of inherent social inequality is coded that way, even in a way that complaining about economic issues is not.
Yeah. No, exactly. And
you
say
you even feel kind of icky talking about these issues.
I do. Yeah, I don't like saying it because it like. Like, look, I mean, I've been with over 100 women, so like, I feel like, I don't know, personally, I know that I'm not an incel, but I still sort of feel like an incel because I was when I was a very young guy. So it's like, I sort of want to avoid talking this way because it does, I don't know, it does make me feel so, like, I think you need a guy who's just very naturally Chad-like, somebody who's never had any problems with women ever. Like, that's the only person who can say this, because if a guy who's like remotely nerdy or remotely weird talks about this in any way, it comes off as repulsive. It's like it has a stink attached to it. But you, like, look, the vast majority of men are suffering in a really bad way from Tinder. And like, it would be fine if you could just go ask a woman out in person, but among Zoomers, that's really stigmatized. Like, I think your generation was probably the last one that could really comfortably go ask a girl out. But these days, like, a 20-year-old guy isn't going to just go to a bar. I mean, come on.
I think the only really option is, like, having a built-in social circle. And even then, there's still some stigmas. I wanted to ask you, so I wrote this essay called The Intersectionality of the Smart But Poor. I'm trying to really decipher, like, pinpoint who this demographic is. So I think high IQ people who are not successful. So I think it's generally they tend to be slightly autistic and they lack the charisma to go to become a lawyer, go that path for high IQ. So high IQ word cells generally, like, they'll do best as a lawyer, but at the same time, if they struggle with math, then STEM is less of an option. So I'm really trying to kind of decipher that demographic. High disagreeableness. So who would you say is the demographic of, like, the smart but poor? And what would be – which field would you say, like, what is your advice for that demographic?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So I knew a guy. He was my best friend for a long time. He was a pretty high-ranking guy in the alt-right. Like, he, you know, a pretty prolific figure. Probably the only person I've met, like, on a personal level, who I thought was, like, noticeably more intelligent than me. And I know that sounds smug, but, I mean, it's just kind of true. I think this guy probably had, like, a 150 IQ or higher. Like, incredibly brilliant guy. But he also was just a giant asshole. And it's, like, if you ever read that letter that, like, Schopenhauer's mother wrote to him about...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was this guy down to a T. No, I mean, it wasn't like he was a dick all the time. Like, he could be very... Like, if you're somebody like me who's very disagreeable, you could find him, like, sort of charming. But, like, to a normie who, especially, like, because he and I both went to the Midwest together, I mean, he just could not, he fit in there worse than me, right? I mean, because the people there were just incredibly, I don't know, like, you needed to treat them with kid gloves. And he and I, like, one time we went to, like, St. Louis, we were, you know, driving through the Midwest on a road trip, and, like, we were in this, like that arch ride, you know, you go up to the top of the St. Louis Arch, and we were in there with, like, this, like, Midwestern couple. They were from like Minnesota or something. And
I think I heard you tell the story on your show.
Yeah. He was telling them that we should tear down the Statue of Liberty because it had that, like, it has words written by a Jewish communist, and he was half Jewish. It was funny. But anyway, so yeah, I mean, like, it was making them really uncomfortable. He just would do that kind of stuff all the time. And I found it charming and everything, but he was way more disagreeable than me. So this is the sort of person I'm thinking of. I mean, I helped him get a bunch of jobs over the years that, like, you know, like, he was making like 50 grand, 60 grand. Like, he could have, like, ridden it out and had a six-figure income in just a few years if he had really stuck with it, because he was very smart. But he just, like, he would start fights at work over stupid things. Like, one time this fat guy, like, ate some of his peanuts that were on his desk, and he got, like, really mad that the fat guy ate his peanuts, and he, like, caused this big fight with this guy when this guy was, like, sort of his supervisor, and, like, he sort of needed him as a reference. Anyway, just, like, shit like that. Like, he just didn't know how to handle conflicts in a good way. And he always, he had, like, this sort of mindset of, like, you can't cuck ever when it comes to, like, you know, like, your personal boundaries or your personal dignity, which I respect. But there's sometimes, like, you need to cuck at work so you have the liberty to not cuck in any other aspect of your life, or you need to sort of just create, like, this one realm where you do kiss someone's ass, and they're a patron that allows you to, like, never have to kiss anyone else's ass, right? And, like, he wasn't good at that. And the thing is, like, look, you have to do that less as you age. And once you're, like, 30, you know, years old or something, typically, like you've built enough of a bubble that you can, you know, you're okay. But when you're, like, 22, 23 years old, like, you kind of just have to kiss someone's ass, right? Like, it's just, you don't have any power unless you're just born very rich. And I think there's a lot of guys like that. They just start fights over stupid reasons. And I think somebody like that, like, their best bet, do a coding boot camp and I think they should do job stacking, number one. And I think that they should just get work at companies they don't mind getting fired from, and just, like, work several remote jobs at once, and just sort of, like, build a cushion for yourself so you're allowed to be sort of an asshole. You know, either that or do what I'm doing right now in Substack, try to turn that into like an income. But I mean, you need to figure out something that works for you.
About Substack, so I'm not right now, like my focus is just growing my subscriber base. I'm at about 1,200. I'm not heavily focused on, I'm going to wait until I have about 2,000 subscribers until I really think about monetization. But there's like a small handful of people like Glenn Greenwald who are actually making several million, like maybe some people might make like 12 million a year on Substack. Do you think it's a viable way to make a living?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what I'm going for right now. I wouldn't be as, you know, prolific as I am if I didn't think that. So I just came back and I'm making like 500 a month right now. So, you know, I think if I keep scaling up at the rate I have been.
Yeah, so like I'm pretty much giving out everything for free, but if I make people become like my page ads, my rough estimate is that's probably close to what I get.
Yeah, so like my ratio right now is
if you don't mind asking, yeah. Like just to compare, like my subscribers are about 1,200. What are yours?
950, and then okay. And then I have 120.
Really close.
Yeah, so I comp a bunch of e-celebs and stuff because I want the e-celebs to watch my stuff because then they'll be promoting me, right? So I don't know if I've comped you. Have I? If not, I will.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I'll comp you.
My friend Pillator, he came up with a slang term for people who aggressively pump each other. He calls them blowjob kings.
I mean, you know.
But it's what you have to do.
You got to do. No, yeah, I mean, I think you and I should pump each other up for sure. I think that, like, my goal is to promote Substack as a platform so that, like, a bunch of guys like me can just quit their job and just, like, focus on content all day. And it seems weird to me that you haven't had Peter Thiel or some sort of, like, I feel like if you just had a billionaire paying guys like that.
Peter Thiel is, like, I think when Baff got accused of getting Thiel bucks, like he said, that the problem with Thiel is maybe he does some good, but he funds the really kind of safe, boring, more conservative stuff. Like, I don't really see Thiel funding the more interesting stuff. He should, but he's not.
I mean, I feel like what about Notch or what about, like, Mark Anderson? Like, there's a bunch of people who – I feel like if any of these guys just gave me, like, $50,000, like, it would be enough for me to just, like, change the world in a really short amount of time. Because, like, I can make anything go viral. Like, I'm really good at marketing, right? Like, I can make anything go viral, like, automatically. Like, so – It sort of just pisses me off that I haven't gotten money from any of these billionaires. But, you know, maybe eventually. See, I'm going to dox myself soon and start facebagging. And at that point, I think I can.
So what is your long-term plan is to create sort of like a coffee salon for anti-establishment, high human capital, but also you want to create like a counter-elite.
Yes, and I want to there's a few things I want to do. I want to, like, sort of subsidize an artistic scene and be a sort of curator and a sort of a curator of both artists and intellectuals, right? And an amplifier. So, like, I'm already doing this now. Like, anyone who's kind of small on Substack who I think has good opinions, I just amplify them. And I sort of, like, develop that, like, friendship network. And I also, like, in my private chat and in my community, you know, we'll do, like, little polls or surveys or just little, like, fun community things. You know, I think it's just a way of kind of bringing people together. And I'm sort of creating, like, a extended walls right around me. And, like, you know, like, I'll promote those people and help them grow. And the fun thing about stuff, like, well, any internet platform, and, you're probably very familiar with this, it's sort of like feudalism, right? It's sort of like you're a king and you have all these, like, dukes, right, who are, like, you know, major figures in your community who, like, go out and, like, conquer land for you. And, like, you know, they'll be, like, reply guys, like, responding to people in your comment section. And then,
oh, yeah.
Like, you know, like, they'll put out their own content and then you'll promote that and then help them grow. It's like a, you know, symbiotic sort of relationship. So, you know, I've sort of built that around myself and I'm sort of like that for Hanania, right? Like, I'm sort of one of his reply guys. So, you know, it's all like an extended universe. But yeah, it's interesting. And I think there's a lot of ways, like guys like us have to promote each other and, like, you know, like, cross pollinate. Cause that's how this thing, like, that's how we'll both get rich, right? Cause people who give me money will give you money. And, like, you know, and that some people say there's not enough, like, too many people are doing their own, like, publication and like, you know, putting things behind paywall.
Substack is great because it filters out a lot of people. You have to be pretty smart. The problem with YouTube is anyone could get on YouTube, and then it became oversaturated, and basically very few people could get rich in YouTube.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, it is good that it is sort of, like, at least right now, it's pretty select, and not everyone tries to do the paywall. Like, you have to be putting out good content to really make the paywall work. But, you know, like, to anybody who's naturally a leader in the community, it's like just like it's an easy way to just monetize that and get, you know, a few thousand bucks, like, without – it's not that hard if you're already someone who just produces good content that people like. And I knew from my Walt Disney
days. I mean, I probably could with my subscribers. I'm just sort of waiting. I want to wait until I get to 2,000 because right now I'm focused more on just building my audience and getting my message out and growing my brand.
Yeah, what I will say is there's nothing wrong with that, but I think you can put out some stuff that will just help you like start to build that up. Like, and you, like, you don't have to, like, you can pursue both strategies simultaneously is what I'm saying. And like what you do is you just, you have certain stuff that's for growing your audience, right? Stuff that you know is going to go viral or stuff, you know, that's going to be just big. And then you have some stuff that I do like for my songs or for my interviews that are a little edgier. It's great for stuff that's a little edgier, like it's kind of ambiguous whether it's inside or outside the Overton window, because you know, like the ADL interns aren't going to be paying $5 a month to look at your stuff. So, you know, it's good for that kind of stuff. So like you can just like choose which content like sort of subsidizes the rest, right? But like it's something you can sort of like, if I were you, what I would do is I would sort of phase into it, right? Like figure out like which stuff that like is more passion project stuff or stuff that like this form, stuff that's more for your like core, because I'm sure you know there's some people on your channel or on your Substack who are more prolific commenters than others, probably really like your like super fans.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so find the Robert Stark super fans and give them like pandering stuff that they can pay for, right? And then the other stuff for like more normies, people who are less super fans, they can just, you know, be free fags and, you know. You just like appeal to both crowds at once.
Before we wrap up, do you have anything else you'd like to add about any of your upcoming projects?
I guess I'm going to be going on Kashuda's show this week, so that'll be interesting. We're probably going to be talking about the sort of like gender war on Twitter. You know, there's a lot of like young guys who have been like bullying her or whatever. So I think that's an interesting topic. And my take on that, which I want to start sort of like mainstreaming, is that it's like older guys who need to show leadership. And especially a lot of these, like, you know, 15, 16 year old, like Zoomer kids, I guess Gen Alpha maybe at this point, like I think that the problem is it's not really, we shouldn't be blaming them. We should be blaming like older guys for not leading them. So I guess that's kind of one thing I'm interested in. Yeah. Other than that, I plan to have Spencer on my podcast soon. So that'll be interesting. So yeah, definitely tune into that. I think yeah, you and I should definitely, you know, keep talking in the future. It would be great to have you on again.
We should do a follow-up show in like several months.
Yeah, absolutely. Because there were actually a few of your articles that I wanted to talk to you about. Like I saw you, your article about Semitic neutralism, I found really interesting. I think that actually
We've this is sort of like a broadly, like I interviewed you and you asked me some questions. So yeah, maybe in like a couple months, if you want to interview me about my articles and get more specific into the details of my articles, we can do that.
I think that sounds like a great idea. But yeah, no, this has been a great, great talk. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This has been great.
Yeah, of course. All right. Have a good rest of your evening.
Take care. Bye.
Yep, bye-bye.